once I see that the device works properly, it release me.
I very much doubt it. You see, before you reactivated it, I reversed the polarity of the neutron flow.
You realize what will happen?
Oh, yes. Do you? Well, I've reversed the polarity of the neutron flow, so the TARDIS should be free of the force field now.
So he's reversed the polarity! Keep back!
Hello and welcome to L'Inversion de la Polarité. Cette semaine, on vous expliquer comment Dr. Q est le froid gay et European. My name is A, my pronouns are they, them.
Bonjour, we had the same idea for a joke.
Hey!
Je m'appelle Rosie et j'utilise le pronom IL. Ce semaine, nous avons regardé le feuilleton Le Reign of Terror par la première série de Doctor Who avec le premier Docteur Barbara Ian O'Susan. Il a été écrit par Dennis Spooner. Aime, comment dit-on en français? This is my fucking jam!
Oh, I don't speak conversational French well enough. I can understand, I just cannot think of the vocab to reply. I had to prepare that and get my friend to check it. And
yeah.
In future, you can do all the bilingual stuff.
I'm so glad we had the same joke. Because, well, behind the scenes of the podcast, we had to bump this one forward, so I was no longer doing the intro, and I'd had this idea for the intro joke for literally months.
I just woke up this morning, I was like, oh, I know what I need to do.
Yes. Anyway, hello, welcome to Reversing Polarity. We're Rosie and Aime. And we both like to make jokes about French, I guess.
We also both like Doctor Who.
Yes, we do both love Doctor Who. And I especially love Barbara Wright and Ian Chesterton, which is why I'm so pleased that we have watched The Reign of Terror this episode.
Which is set in France, if you didn't know, in case you were wondering what the fuck we were doing.
Had you seen this one before, Aime?
No, I hadn't. This is one I had not seen. I mean, I've definitely seen enough of this like TARDIS team to know what to expect from it. It was a traumatic time.
Yeah,
I don't think I can quite call it a good time because everyone had a bad time.
Yeah. Had you seen a pure historical before? I feel like that's the best. Yeah, because
I haven't.
I thought about it. I have watched The Romans, but The Romans is an interesting point of comparison to this one because similarly traumatic things happen, but the tone is completely different.
Yeah, the tone of this is just fucking bleak.
Yeah, which makes sense and is appropriate for the subject matter. I had not seen it either. I bought the DVD recently because I don't think it's on BritBox. More's the pity, and it has the two episodes of extremely strange animation. But you know,
I liked it.
No, I liked it too. It's just very different to all the other animations. This is kind of when they were still trying to figure out what they wanted to do with it, I guess.
And maybe they had a bit of a bigger budget.
Yes, but as mentioned, we can discuss that more later in the episode. Yeah, I mean, I don't know very much about the French Revolution either, except for what is mentioned in Les Misérables, the book, which I have read.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know much apart from what's mentioned in Les Mis, the musical.
Which is not very much. Yeah, so kind of that, and then the Horrible Histories one. Like, there is a Horrible Histories book about it. I think.
I definitely had that as a kid, but I have a lot, and I have not retained much of that information. Yeah. I'm sorry.
I can't remember which one that was. Hang on, I'm going to look up which Horrible Histories book it was, because I swear they had a thing about the tricoteurs and all that, knitting in front of the guillotine. No, I don't mean the TV series, I mean the series of books. Come on, guys. There we go.
While you're searching, I did once go and see the Horrible Histories stage show at the Edinburgh Fringe, and we were the only people above the age of 18 in the audience apart from parents, and we had a blast. It was amazing.
Yeah. I went to see a Rotten Romans one in, like,
nice.
2011, and it was great. Let's see. What would it be?
Ooh, Ghost is coming back this month.
Yes! Oh my god, it's coming back
That's
in, like, 8 days.
That's going to be a good time.
I'm so fucking psyched.
There's so much good shit happening in August.
Yeah, one of the storylines is apparently that one of the ghosts turns out to have been assassinated, and it's like, oh my god, what?
Which one?
Well, it's got to be either Kitty or the Captain, but we don't know
which. We've not really done their stories yet.
No.
I would like to know more about Kitty.
Yes.
She's my favourite. My beloved.
Yes, I love her. Okay, so there is a special book just called France, which is probably that one.
That sounds
2002.
Typically British.
Yes. It would be called, like, Frightful France. And if any listeners don't know Horrible Histories, you should absolutely get on that, especially the sketch comedy show.
It's so good. In my household, we quote it numerous times a week.
Oh, absolutely.
We have had parties themed around it.
Yes, I have seen the Series 2 blooper reel, I think, probably 30 times. just for the bit where Jasper Maskelyne fails to disappear below the table. Anyway,
we have a long episode ahead of us. We do have a long episode about Horrible Histories. So, the Reign of Terror. Do you want to tell us what happens in The Reign of Terror?
The Reign of Terror is a 6-part serial, a pure historical. We haven't covered a pure historical on the podcast before, and I'm very excited about it because love history. So, the TARDIS materialises not far from Paris in 1794, one of the bloodiest years following the French Revolution of 1789. The travellers become involved with an escape chain rescuing prisoners from the guillotine and get caught up in the machinations of an English undercover spy, James Stirling, alias Le Maître, governor of the Conciergerie prison. Now, that is a massive spoiler for the whole serial, but we have seen it. Maybe I should, I guess, just watch it. Just watch the serial. It's quite good.
I feel like if people have listened to our podcast before, they know that they're about to get spoiled for the entire story.
Yes. Also, we are still early enough in the show that the individual episodes have titles, which is, of course, my favourite thing. And there's some great titles in this one.
Starting with A Land of Fear. Yes. Fantastic title. Could be the name of another Land Before Time movie.
Absolutely.
So, sadly, we're not yet on Doctor Who and the Dinosaurs.
One day.
What? Can't fucking wait. It's a favourite. Anyway, so episode one starts with the Doctor, Ian, Barbara and Susan arriving at the destination that the Doctor says is 1960s Earth, England. He intends on throwing Ian and Barbara out there and then, but they convince him that they should just check to see if they are where he says they are.
This is fantastic, and it's such fun character stuff as well. Like, he's like, well, here it is, England 1963, go! And they're like, we're just waiting for you to do the checks, Doctor. We're not 100% sure that you're going to have got us there.
Your track record is not very good.
Yeah. and I think at one point they say, what, you thought you got us home once before? Yes, and then we met Marco Polo. It's like, stop reminding us that Marco Polo is a lost story. But then Ian kind of gets close and like butters the Doctor up, and Barbara comes in on the other side and is like, why don't we go have a drink just to say goodbye? Also, before they do this, Susan gives them both a hug and runs off, and I'm like, Susan!
It's also like, it's the last episodes of Series 1, I think, and they've really got their dynamic sorted.
Yeah, it's really
good. They have such good chemistry as a group. I really like it. So they leave the TARDIS and it's clear they're on Earth, but they note how dark it is and that there are no streetlights around. Ian investigates and finds a small feral boy in the woods, as you do. Small feral boy. After questioning, the boy informs them that they're in France, 12 kilometres from Paris. The Doctor states that 100 miles from the intended destination, well, not perfect, is pretty good. I love my chaos boy.
Yes.
Before they can question the boy anymore, he runs off, so they explore and eventually find an abandoned house. They split up and explore it. Barbara, Ian and Susan begin to suspect that they aren't in 1963 when they find 18th century furniture and clothes around the house. They also found fake papers, some of which bear the signature of Robespierre, the chief orchestrator of government during the Reign of Terror in the year 1794.
No one in this serial can decide how to pronounce Robespierre. Because my inclination is to go Robespierre, right? Like properly French. They go Robespierre. Robespierre. And it's like, I know that that's technically an English pronunciation of it, but it sounds so wrong.
It makes me imagine like somebody making a little cape for their spear.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I do like that although Ian decides that they're in the French Revolution, Barbara points out that it's the Reign of Terror. And it's like, yeah, she is the history teacher, guys.
She is. Yes. She is great because of that throughout. They deduce the farmhouse as being used as a staging post in an escape chain for counter-revolutionaries. They put on some of the clothes so as not to look conspicuous when they go back to the TARDIS. Ian goes to look for the Doctor, but as he leaves, he's accosted by two counter-revolutionaries named Dagenson and Rouvray. My pronunciation is going to be like
this. I think it's Dagenson, but it's not clear.
Yeah. They hold a gun to Barbara, Ian and Susan and ask if they're loyal to the revolution or are counter-revolutionaries like themselves.
You're either with us or against us.
They ask if they're travelling alone and Barbara says they are. Rouvray says this is a lie, they found the Doctor upstairs. They assure them that he's alright, but they're still hostile to the travellers.
The bit where they're dressing up is also very cute. I just want to point that out because
it's very cute.
Once again, Ian and Barbara are married across all of time and space. They are the most married. I love them so much.
They just love each other so much.
They are so in love. It's like, it's just very sweet at parts of the serial. In this one, it's Barbara asks how she looks and Ian goes, "Very pretty, mademoiselle." And you're like, oh!
It's so nice.
They do a similar thing in The Romans as well, where they're even more married because it's further along in the series. And you're like, yeah, it makes sense that they would go home and get married and have children. It's like, yeah, that's them.
Yeah, I buy it. A band of revolutionary soldiers surround the house and demands their collective surrender. Instead of storming the house, they wait outside, counting on the counter-revolutionaries to lose their nerve. Dodgenson, who has seemed nervous from the off, gives himself up, thinking that his surrender will spare him the guillotine. Reluctantly, Rouvray joins him, and they are both killed.
Oof. Dodgenson is, like, properly traumatised at this point. Like, you know, he starts, like,
and that's just
crying,
sort of, like, setting the tone.
Like, mate, because his whole family got guillotined, even his little sister, and you're like, oh my god, this poor guy.
Hell. Yeah. And then, had time.
Yeah, and then in the book, in this they both get shot. In the book, one of them gets bayoneted to death, like, stabbed repeatedly.
Jesus!
You're like, Ian Martyr, come on.
Ow. That's a lot.
Yeah. I read the novelization this time.
Congratulations.
I finished the serial and I was like, I want to read the novelization, which is a very, very rare feeling, I'll be honest.
I mean, it's just so, such a telling point of how much this is your shit.
Yeah, this is extremely my shit.
The soldiers enter the house and capture Ian, Barbara and Susan, thinking they are counter-revolutionaries too. They inform them that they'll be marched to Paris and the guillotine. The soldiers set fire to the farmhouse, unaware the doctor is inside. The travellers stare at the house as the roof falls in and the doctor lies unconscious on the floor.
Oh, the drama. The fucking drama of it all.
I really like this as a setup episode.
Yeah, it's a really good setup episode. I think it's good because it kind of sets the pace in the sense that not necessarily a lot happens, but what does happen, they go into quite a lot of depth. So you actually feel like they're in a place and time that is lived in.
Yeah. And I like the sort of deduction of it, especially in the first half, putting the bits together to figure out where and when they are.
Indeed. It's like, it's a little bit of detective work and it's very fun. And I love how much the Doctor refuses to admit that he has made a mistake.
Very in character.
His very first Doctor. He's so grumpy and it's very fun. And then he gets whacked in the head and joins the concussion crew.
I mean, it wouldn't be 60s serial. Who without that.
No, it wouldn't be 60s Who without head trauma.
Or just general trauma.
Or just general trauma, yeah, I was about to say. Just trauma of all kinds. Yeah, I like that they take it seriously. You know, Dodgenson and Rouvray's death is not, like, swept away. They do mention it later on. It's all very sad. There's this great bit where Rouvray comes out and is like, everyone stop! Because, you know, he used to be, like, a commander in the army or whatever. And he does convince them for a second, but it doesn't quite work. It's a good scene. And also he, like, goes, you come here, and, like, takes his gun and throws it on the ground. And you're like, oh my god. Like, it's kind of the start of some iffy class stuff in the serial. But it is kind of a baller moment divorced from that context.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait to discuss that later.
Oh boy. All right.
Do you want to guide us through episode 2?
Yes. Episode 2, Guests of Madame Guillotine. They say guillotine.
Brilliant
in this,
title. Fucking hell.
It is. It's so good. They say guillotine a lot, but I like saying guillotine. It feels, you know, very cool, very powerful. Yes. Once in Paris, Barbara, Ian and Susan are sentenced to death for being traitors to the revolution. Barbara is like, are we not going to be allowed to speak on our own behalf? And the guy's like, no, you traitors do not get to speak. Woof. It's kind of a deliberate parallel to the first episode where Rouvray and Dodgenson are like, well, we do allow you to speak in your own defense, even though we are enemies or whatever. And you're like, ah, yes, they're setting up a parallel.
Who is the good and who is the bad?
Yes, they're imprisoned with William Russell going on holiday for 2 weeks and Susan and Barbara being put in a separate cell. Once Ian has been dispatched, the lecherous prison warden says that he would be able to help the two girls escape, but Barbara turns this down, sensing he would ask for a little more than the company he says he seeks, and she slaps him in the face.
Yeah, powerful. So we love Barbara.
Yeah.
She did the right thing.
Yeah. It is. We haven't seen Barbara in a while. The first time we saw Barbara in the serial, in the podcast, it was Keys of Marinus, where she does get harassed. And then in this one, she also gets harassed. But in this one, she gets to slap him in the face, which is very satisfying. In the book, she's wearing a ring and it like cuts his cheek open and you're like, yes!
Oh, nice!
It's like a proper Les Mis reference, right? Like, obviously there's the Fontaine slapping the guy. I do wonder whether Dennis Spooner had read Les Mis. Or seen one of the several filmic adaptations that had come out at this point.
Mm. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. Once Ian has been dispatched, oh, I've already said that. Susan is distraught at their predicament and confides to Barbara that she is worried about her grandfather, fearing his death. Obviously, they hadn't.
I mean, fair. They've just seen him burn in the house.
Yeah, they hadn't set up regeneration at this point, but still, it would not be great. It would not be great. However, the doctor is not dead. He was saved from the blaze by the young boy that they encountered outside the TARDIS, Jean-Pierre. He's lovely. He's a very sweet little boy.
He's very nice.
Yes, I think he's the first ever child actor in Doctor Who, which is such an odd
really?
Thought. Yeah, because this was like the whole serial. The director was so stressed out and they, you know the rule about never working with children or animals? Well, they work with both children and animals.
The director had to have a short stint in hospital to recover from his stress.
Yes, it was a lot. He informs the doctor that his companions have been taken to the Conciergerie prison in Paris. After thanking the boy, he sets off after them. And there's a very helpful sign outside the Conciergerie prison, which says, Conciergerie prison, which is very French. Barbara begins to plot a way out of their cell. She immediately does this, and I really appreciate it. She's
of course
like,
you do.
She's like great escaping the whole time, which is very fun because I found out today that William Russell was in The Great Escape.
Was he?
Yeah, nice. I think it was like a bit part, but still, he's a very prolific actor. He was in something like last year, and I was like, thank God he's still alive.
Wow, what a career.
Yeah, yeah. They still should have put him in Doctor Who when Clara was working at Coal Hill School, and I'll be forever bitter that they
cowards.
Did not.
Cowards.
Forever.
They could
bitter.
Do something with him for the 60th anniversary.
He was he was listed as the governor of the school. He was like the chair of governors, and you're like, even just the webisode.
Just show him.
Just the webisode about your Justin. Anyway, I'm fine. I'm not mad.
Lies.
Yes, she notices that the wall to her cell is wet, and that means that there must be some kind of sewer system below the cell. She thinks that the moistness of the wall means that with a bit of time and effort, she could pry one of the bricks out from the wall. She sets about doing this using one of the planks from the bed as a primitive crowbar. Sick.
Powerful. I love this.
It's so good. Like, Susan is like, how are we supposed to get out of here? Because Susan is not practically minded, I think. She's not a very practically minded person, which is fair enough.
She's very book smart.
Yeah, like, the Academy on Gallifrey can teach you to fake your own death, but it doesn't teach you how to get your way out of a prison cell.
Priorities.
Yes. Meanwhile, Ian has been put in a cell with a dying man by the name of Webster. Webster is also English and with his dying breath tells Ian that he was sent over from England to find James Stirling, who has precious information that will help England fight the inevitable war with France. Webster makes...
My friend has a cat called Webster. distinguish the two while listening.
That's fair enough.
We're watching.
Webster makes Ian promise to Webster makes Ian promise to seek out Stirling and tells him to return to England. Ian promises that he will do so. Webster then dies. Now, this paragraph does not communicate how close they are while they're speaking. It's very homoerotic, and I'm glad you agree.
Yep, that was in my notes in all caps, and then I saw you'd already noted it. I was like, good, I'm glad.
I'm sure we can discuss it more later. I'm very glad we had some gay shit this week. I feel like we've been deprived recently.
We've been in like a gay desert.
Yeah, just no gay. It's very, very sad. The Doctor, on his way to Paris, encounters a chain gang. He asks the leader of the chain gang, an aggressive and violent man, whether he is on the road to Paris, and the leader says he is. The leader complains that his men are slow and that he has been ordered to finish this section of the road before tomorrow. The Doctor suggests that instead of being violent towards his men, he should aid them in their effort. The leader responds badly to this, insists on seeing the Doctor's identification papers, and when he can't provide them, orders him to join in the manual work. Yeah, the Doctor's just kind of been, like, wandering down some lovely avenues of tall, straight trees.
Yeah, he's been having just a jolly, basically.
Yes. My favourite fact about this is that it's not William Hartnell walking down all those avenues. so it adds yet another person to that fucking mastermind question, how many people have portrayed the Doctor on screen? Well, it depends what you mean by portray.
Apparently, to get this right, the guy like mirroring him, the double had to follow him around on set for a while, which really pissed off William Hartnell.
I think everything pissed off William Hartnell.
Yep.
He was already pissed off because the director wasn't English, and it's like, oh, William Hartnell.
Oh, William Hartnell, please don't be a racist.
I mean, yeah, I mean, he was, but we kind of have to accept that at this point, owing to the fact that he's been dead for 60 years or whatever, 50 years.
Be impressive if he'd portrayed the Doctor as a ghost.
Yeah, really, really impressive. I can't estimate time. It's the summer holidays and I don't have to do maths. Back in the prison, the girls are startled when they are almost discovered digging their hole. Their work is brought to a halt later when they discover that rats are coming in through the hole and infesting their cell. Because Susan is distraught at this, Barbara says they will stop. Poor Susan.
Poor Susan.
She's under a lot of stress. I'm not convinced that they have rats.
I mean, she's
rats
in a fucking 1700s French prison cell. Of course she's under a lot of stress.
Yeah. And apparently it's like the worst cell on purpose because the jailer was of course mad that Barbara would not sleep with him. It's like,
yeah.
Ugh.
Fuck that.
This did remind me, number one, of the rats, the family of rats in A Little Princess that Sarah befriends. The big one that she calls Melchizedek and imagines herself being in the Bastille, and you're like, oh yeah, okay. And then it also reminded me that the other day I saw a rat crossing the road.
I like rats.
Yeah, me
generally.
Too. I like rats. I've never seen one just like outside in the middle of the day, but it was a little grey rat and it just bounded its way across the road, and I was like, oh, go on, go about your business, little dude.
Nice, nice, very good.
Very sweet little man.
If I didn't have cats, I would have rats. However, I don't think the two are massively compatible. No. Anyway.
Over in Ian's cell, a nobleman named Lemaitre comes in and inspects the body of Webster. He orders Ian to tell him whether Webster said anything to him before his death. Ian tells the man that he didn't, but the prison warden states he heard them talking. The nobleman takes Ian's name off the list of people to be executed. Ooh, intrigue.
Ooh, yeah.
Ian is clearly not doing great emotionally at this point. Neither are Barbara and Susan, of course, but they at least have each other to talk to, whereas Ian is stuck
Ian
in a cell with a dead body.
Stuck with a corpse.
Yeah. They're like, when did he die? And he's like, a few hours ago? Like, why is this important? There we are. Good on Ian for just not telling the guy, you know. He spends a lot of time in this serial refusing to be complicit with things, and you're like, hell yeah, Ian. You're good.
Good on Ian.
You're a good egg.
He's really good. I left the serial being like, I think that's my favourite Ian story, just because of how much he's like that.
Yeah, he is so like that, and it's so great. Dun dun. Back at the chain gang. Sorry, it is a serious thing, but it's also like the Doctor just gets handed this pickaxe and he's still wearing his whole outfit and he's just like half-heartedly like pickaxing these plaster boulders that the crew has made.
It's very comedic.
It's very comedic. It's a good change of pace. Back at the chain gang, the Doctor has devised a plan whereby he will gain his freedom as well as the freedom of the others. He creates a distraction for the leader by saying that there is to be an eclipse. As the leader looks to the sun, the Doctor steals some money from the leader's purse. The men go back to their digging, and the Doctor hides some money in the soil and pretends to uncover it, saying that he has found buried treasure.
It's a con. I wish they'd made more of this, actually.
It's such a panic plan. You're like, how can I get him to look away? I know, I'll say there's going to be an eclipse, apparently.
Which, I mean, it's enough to distract them.
Yeah, I suppose so. The greedy leader begins to take over the digging, and whilst he is distracted, the Doctor knocks him over the head, rendering him unconscious, in quotation marks. Now, I'm fairly
head
convinced
trauma,
this would kill someone.
Two.
I'm fairly convinced this would kill someone.
Okay, like, no, please elaborate on
here's
that
the
comment.
Thing. He hits him very hard over the head with a metal shovel. That would fracture his skull. This is the 1700s. That guy's dead. Whether he's dead now or will be dead soon, he's gonna die of head trauma.
I would argue about the force with which he was hit.
Well, it's like a lever, right? So he holds it right at the bottom as the fulcrum. There's the entire force of that spade as it goes from the ground and then round like 270 degrees and whacks the guy on the head. And he falls over and he's unconscious. That kind of head trauma is very bad for you.
Are you telling me that there was a murder committed by Doctor Who?
I am fairly convinced.
Oh my god, a first.
I am fairly convinced that this guy's dead. And it's like, you know, this Doctor is very willing to murder. We know this because it comes up in 10,000 BC. Not that we've seen that one officially yet. And I know that textually he doesn't kill him, but it's kind of like the Batman argument, right? Where people say, well, sure, Batman may not officially kill people, but he does beat people into unconsciousness, which usually is not supposed to happen. Like, you're not supposed to black out after being hit in the head.
No, well, no.
I know that it happens in TV a lot. But I just worry about, I worry about this jailer. Like, I think he was a bad dude, but I don't think murder is good. I think murder is bad, actually. Hard stance on the podcast.
Yeah, I mean, I find it quite amusing.
I mean, it is a funny scene. It's a funny scene.
Just the fact that William Hartnell has this very much grandfatherly energy and he just goes around literally killing people.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it.
He's a murderer.
I don't like it, but I like it.
It's very fun to consider the context of knowing how, like, head trauma works, especially as a fan of hockey, which is a very contact sport. I'm just like, oh man, this guy's not going to be very well after this.
Ow.
He's going to go and get, a trepanation done to try and relieve the pressure on his brain, and they'll just have a big hole in his skull.
Big hole. Mm. And then he probably wouldn't survive that easily.
No, no. Although people have, you know, people have in the past. Like, I just know this mostly from the Amber Spyglass, so, like, do correct me if necessary.
I'm thinking of Phineas Gage.
Yeah, so. Phineas Gage. Although I guess that's not technically a trepanation in that it wasn't, like, a deliberate drilling. It was more like a very traumatic...
But it is a very, very strong head trauma.
It is a very strong head trauma, yeah. That one was unusual, though, because it, like... It went through the bits of his brain that were non-essential, right? To, like, breathing and walking around.
Yeah, so he had all the functions, but then bits were just not there.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Highly recommend.
They should have him as a historical character on Doctor Who, I think. Just the Phineas Gage episode.
Hey, Chris Chibnall. We know you've got 3 specials coming.
Yeah, the Phineas Gage special.
Give us the Phineas Gage.
God. As the Doctor moves on, he passes a sign indicating he is 5 kilometres from Paris. However, it may be too late as the prison warden comes to Barbara and Susan's cell and informs them that it is time for their execution.
No!
As they are led out to the wagon that will take them to their death, Ian looks out of his prison window in shock. God! God.
This was literally... I was watching this and it nearly broke me and I can't imagine how you would have felt.
It hurt. And, like, obviously they filmed... I wasn't joking about William Russell going on holiday. He was on holiday for the filming of episodes 2 and 3. So they took him off to a separate studio and filmed all of his inserts for episode 2 and 3 at once. So, like, there's some bits where you expect Ian and he is not there. Like, the bit where Susan is like, Ian, where are you? You expect him to call from the cell he's been put in, but he doesn't because he's not there. He's in, like, the south of France or something.
Leeds. Okay, yeah, no, that's more
glamorous. But, you can tell they're film inserts because the quality of the film is different. But, like, it works really, really well for just, like, the harrowing nature of him being separated from Barbara and Susan. He's staring out of the window of his cell going, Barbara! Susan! And then the episode ends.
He just looks,
like,
so forlorn.
Oh, my God. He's properly... It's a bad time to be in Cheston. Like, this is the second time while we've recorded the podcast, this is the second serial with Ian in where he has been left alone to await execution.
Which, I mean, that's more times than I've ever been in that situation.
Yeah, it's more times than anyone would like to be in that situation, I would imagine. God, poor Ian. And poor Barbara and Susan. Susan is beginning to take ill at this point. Which is her main
understandably
function.
As well.
Yeah, she's very cold. Their blankets are sopping wet because they've been keeping them against the hole so that the jailer doesn't spot it. He, like, comes in at one point and nearly discovers the hole that they've been digging, but then he gets called away by Lemaitre.
It's very close.
Yeah, it's very, very close. It's very stressful.
Shall we go for episode 3?
Absolutely.
Change of identity.
Un change d'identité.
Yes. The Doctor has arrived in Paris and starts to track down his companions. Meanwhile, in another part of Paris, the wagon carrying Susan and Barbara halts to change horses. Ooh. Barbara suggests they could use this opportunity to run, but Susan has too much of a headache. Barbara seems resigned to their fate.
I would say it's more than a headache at this point. She's, like,
she's
almost
got
fainting.
The flu.
Yeah, she is. She's not well.
Yeah, she needs to be looked after.
Also, there's a real horse. It's a real horse. On a studio...
Who thought that was a good idea?
I don't know.
Luckily for them, their transport is hijacked by 2 men, Jules and Jean.
Yay.
Who kill the guards and spirit them back to their safe house.
Extremely good. I like Jules and Jean a lot.
We like these two. Yeah. Back at the prison, the jailer is serving food to the inmates when he's called away by Lemaitre. In his rush to get to his superior, he leaves his set of keys in the lock. While he's gone, Ian finds the keys in the lock, reaches them through the grate, removes the key to his cell, places another key in the lock.
Oh my god.
When the jailer returns, he doesn't notice the difference and thinks he's got away with his forgetfulness.
This is such a stressful scene. You're like, oh my god, is he going to make it? Is he going to get the key?
It's very much Prison Break. The stakes feel really high.
Yeah, it's very Prison Break. I say as someone who's seen probably about 3 seasons of Prison Break.
Oh, I just meant that, and it's literally somebody breaking out of prison. Mm. I've not seen any. I've seen a lot of Ghost Hunters, though. It's fine.
Next season, Ian will come back and he'll have like a cryptic tattoo that turns out to have the blueprints of the prison on it. That's part of the plot of Prison Break.
The yard I'm giving is the stare I'm giving is definitely longer than 50 yards.
Yeah, it's a very weird one.
Meanwhile, in totally normal things, the Doctor wanders the streets and comes across a clothes shop. He gives the shopkeeper all of his clothes, including his ring, for the clothes of a regional officer of the provinces.
So good. So good.
Everyone else is, like, in prison, awaiting death in a bad time, and the Doctor goes fucking shopping.
Yeah, he needs clothes to fit in, and the answer is a very silly hat.
So good. It's got so many feathers.
He really just grifts this tailor as well. Like, I know the tailor is suspicious, but it's still, like, you know, Doctor's very confident he's going to be able to just get these clothes in exchange for his ratty old coat. He's like, but sure, the tailor's like, I don't have much demand for this type of coat. And the Doctor says, but how often do you have this type of coat in stock? How would they know what they're missing?
So good. In the prison, while the jailer is drunk, Ian sneaks out. As he does, Le Maître is watching his every move. Once Ian's gone, Le Maître speculates that his escape would be the only way to see if Webster had said anything about Sterling to Ian before he died. I like how it's a spy story.
Yeah, it's very good. Like, I think that the genre of it really works. The fact that it's kind of a thriller as well as being a historical.
Yeah.
It's not really a period drama in the same way. And I know it was inspired by the Scarlet Pimpernel and all that, so.
Yeah. Back at the safe house, Barbara and Susan are told they will be given food and a place to rest.
And a hot bath.
And then they will be... Very important.
Very important.
And then they'll be smuggled out of France in the escape chain, but Barbara says they can't leave France without the Doctor and Ian.
Absolutely.
Jules
not.
And Jean reassure her that they'll try and reunite the four travellers. When Barbara and Susan tell them how they were arrested, they mention the house in the woods that was burnt down. This shocks the two men, who ask if D'Argenson and Rouvray were there. When the girls tell them that they were and they were killed by the soldiers, Jules informs them that this house was being used as a safe house, and that D'Argenson and Rouvray were people they had saved.
I really like this because they get a map out and then they actually figure out on the map where they were, which is some good kind of cartography, you know. And also they have to try and conceal the fact that they kind of arrived in a spaceship and just don't know where they started from. They go, oh, well, we got lost in the forest and then we emerged here.
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
It's good. Jean and Jules speculate that there must be a traitor giving away the locations of their safe houses. At this point, Susan becomes ill again and Barbara takes her to bed. Another counter-revolutionary, Leon Colbert, arrives and joins their company and flirts with Barbara.
I don't know how Barbara... I can't really figure out how Barbara is responding to the flirting. She definitely likes getting her hand kissed, which is valid. Amusingly, in the book, she thinks that Leon looks a lot like Ian.
Very funny.
Yeah, it is very funny. I don't know whether that was like the impression that Ian Marta had, but yeah, and also she's more suspicious of him as like an internal monologue. She's like, there's something off about this guy.
That's because there is.
There is.
In his new guise of regional officer of the provinces, the Doctor forces his way into the concierge, but is informed by the jailer that all three have gone. The Doctor's about to leave when Le Maître arrives and insists he accompany him to visit First Deputy Robespierre to report on his province. Once he's gone, the shopkeeper comes to the jailer to inform Le Maître of something important. The jailer says he can't be interrupted as he's with Robespierre. The shopkeeper says it's important as he has proof of a traitor. As he says this, he displays the Doctor's ring.
Oh my god! the drama of it all. This is... God, it's just such a pacey story. And I mean that very sincerely. Like, there's always something happening. And it doesn't feel like there's too much backwards and forwardsing. Even when they get rearrested, it kind of makes sense.
It's definitely not slow.
Yeah. Which is odd for a six-parter, but it does change things up often enough. This one's...
It's not fast, but it's not slow.
No, it is not slow. The next episode, we begin the animation. Which is kind of like a... It's hard to describe. It's a very detailed animation style, kind of like in the moon base. But instead of having the mouth movements be like one bit that moves, it's like deep fake... Like, the whole face kind of moves, but in a very odd and kind of robotic way, which I quite enjoy as an animation style, but it is a little bit disconcerting to get used to. like the way that the eyes stretch and kind of morph.
And everything's just a little bit uncanny. It's moving a lot more than the others. Yeah, Uncanny Valley, exactly. It's moving a lot more than the other animation styles.
Yeah.
But still not quite right.
It does feel a lot more true to life in the way that they animate Hartnell. And I really want them to do more Hartnell animations. I know, I think they're doing... Is it Galaxy 4 they're doing?
Galaxy 4 is coming after Fury of... no, the Yeti one. Yeah.
I wish they would do The Crusade, because I liked what I've seen of The Crusade. I thought it was good. And also, obviously, I wish that they would do anything with Ian and Barbara, so that's like the secondary reason.
I want The Highlanders. That has nothing to do with any of the characters we discuss.
Of course, Highlanders.
However, this is my campaign.
It's like, I don't care that the PO Historicals aren't as popular in quotation marks. It's Jamie fucking McCrimmon. Anyway.
I just want more Jamie in my life.
Yeah, all the Jamie, please. Episode 4, The Tyrant of France.
Brilliant title again.
It's all good. Lemaitre takes the Doctor to meet the Tyrant of France, who appears to be a zealot and a psychopath, constantly talking of increasing the pace of execution. The Doctor fails to convince him otherwise, but by the end of the meeting, Robespierre has warned the Doctor and asks if he can return tomorrow. And he never got to talk about his province, which he was so looking forward to.
What a shame. Wonder what province he would have chosen.
I think he's supposed to be from the south. I think maybe they just go, like, the south province. I'm not sure how they named things in the revolution, because obviously, in the book,
the state
they kind of go more
flux.
Into, like, you know, oh, it's to Thermidor or whatever. Like, they go into, like, the revolutionary calendar, which is different, in case anyone was not aware of that.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, they changed it all to metric, so it was, like, I think how it worked... was that there were 10 days in a week.
10 days in a week?
And 10 months in a year, but I can't remember how many days there were in a month. And each day of the... Each month had a different name that was, like, related to revolutionary figures or something. It's been a while, I'm going to Google it.
This sounds incredible. I must know everything about it.
Yeah, it was like... They tried it with everything, because obviously kilometres is, like... The metric system is all French. Yeah, decimal time of day, decimalization of currency, and metrication, which is, you know, measuring things with the metric system. Yeah, so they have 12 months of 30 days each, pardon me, which were given new names based on nature.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So there was Vendémiaire, Brumaire, Frimaire, Niveuse, Pluvieuse, Venteuse. The winter ones mean snowy, rainy, and windy, which is extremely funny to me.
Wow.
Germinal, Floréal, Prairial, Messidor, Thermidor, and Fructidor. So Thermidor just means hot, like it's the hot month. Mm. Fructidor is like fruit, Messidor is harvest. And then the month was divided into 3 10-day weeks. That's where I was going.
Ah, okay.
But yeah, it's just interesting to me.
I had no idea about any of that, so thank you for educating me.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's like a Twitter account out there that says what day it would be today in the calendar every time. But
that's very cool.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot about calendars. I find them really interesting, like how the Romans didn't really measure time in the winter. They just had the 9 months.
Cannot blame them at all.
They had the 9 or the 10 months or whatever, and then the rest of the time they were like, oh, I don't fucking know. It's the winter.
It's too dark. Who cares?
Yeah. It's interesting. Meanwhile, also, I forgot to mention, I like that they have historical figures in this. I know it's not necessarily very historically accurate, but it's very fun. And there's a particular historical figure in episode 6 that people complained about at the time, and I'm like, yes, yes, yes.
I like that they did that.
Yeah, it was very fun. Meanwhile, at the Rebel's house, Susan is still desperately unwell. Leon takes it upon himself to find a physician for her. Barbara and Susan are left by themselves as Jules and Jean are checking out one of their hideouts, and they are shocked to see someone in there. Jules sneaks in and strikes the man. Little do they know, it is Ian!
It's Ian!
It's my boy, Ian! God, I wish these episodes hadn't been destroyed in a bombing raid in the Cypriot Civil War. At least we still have 4 of them, you know?
At least, yep. And... it's still a triumph.
Yeah. When the Doctor and Lemaitre return to jail, the Doctor tries to make excuses and leave, but Lemaitre's insistence and threats from the jailer force the Doctor to stay. Lemaitre returns to his quarters, where he finds the shopkeeper, who informs him of the true nature of the Doctor. He gives the shopkeeper a bag of gold for the Doctor's ring and clothes. There's a lot kind of going on with the jailer and Lemaitre and everything in the background, which I quite enjoy. I like when there's kind of stuff going on that the Doctor and his companions don't know about in a serial.
Especially when it's a serial about, like, spying and infiltration.
Oh, it's so good.
Subterfuge.
And you're like, why hasn't Lemaitre done anything yet? Oh my god, when's he going to make his move? And, you know.
And then.
And then. On returning back to the house with the prostrate body of Ian, Jules and John are shocked to find he is the friend of Barbara. This is so cute. It's so cute.
Mm.
I love them. I love them so much. Amy,
I don't
know
think
this.
You mentioned that at all.
Amy,
this
you know this, but I adore them, and they're so happy to see each other. And Ian thought Barbara and Susan were dead, and he's so happy that they're not. And you're like, oh my god, this is only a short reprieve for Ian, though. Very short reprieve for Ian.
Ian has yet another bad day.
Yeah, Ian's horrible, no good, very bad reign of terror. Incredible stuff. Ian says that he was told to wait for Jules to find the whereabouts of James Sterling. He is disappointed to be informed that Jules has no idea who Sterling is. However, Ian is told that Leon may have more of an idea. Jules arranges a meeting between Ian and Leon. Danielle is Jules' sister, who is very pretty and very suspicious of Leon, and I really admire her. She doesn't get a lot to do, but, you know, she's around.
Hey,
she's
it also means
woman.
We have another woman in the serial.
A named woman. Incredible. There's also some other women that turn up in episode 3 just to jeer at Barbara and Susan while they're in the cart, and it's quite funny.
It's mean.
It is mean, but it's also, like, classic French Revolution happenings, I think.
Yeah.
Let's see. Danielle comes and informs the man that the physician will not visit the house for fear of retribution. It is reluctantly decided that Barbara should take Susan to him. Ian offers to do it, and Jules is like, well, it will be less conspicuous if two women do it. And Ian is like, oh, fine, but he's like pacing around like a fucking tiger in a cage. He's like, I don't want Barbara out there on her own, I need to protect her. And you're like, oh my god, Ian.
I love them.
I love them so much. On arriving at the physician's, he seems suspicious but is willing to treat Susan. He leaves to get some supplies. Leeches. It's leeches. It's leeches. He's going to get leeches.
It's 1794.
It's 1794.
It's going to be leeches.
Yeah, I remember quite a long time ago, I saw some feature on a documentary or something that was about how people are still using leeches in some medicine, which I was like, what the fuck?
How interesting.
It's quite interesting, because it is useful in certain limited cases to drain the blood from an area. Just like, not to just cover someone in leeches when they have a fever. He leaves to get some supplies, and when a suspicious Susan tries to leave, they discover that they have been locked in. The physician is a spy. I mean, I wouldn't say that the physician is a spy. He's just, like, you know, he's informing on them. It has very, like French Resistance vibes, I think, this story. Like, kind of a Second World War parallel is slightly being drawn, I think. If that's just...
Yeah, I definitely see that.
Even if it's just... fucking hell, what am I speaking? Even if it's just, like, the vibe of the, you know, the informers and the informants and the way that the police are immediately there to, like, take people into custody and guillotine. It's interesting. And it probably helps that it's all set in France, although probably for the best, no one has a French accent.
This was actually commented on in the info text. Nobody has a French accent. This is a conscious choice they made, and they decided to use regional British accents to show class instead.
Yeah, which makes sense, because regional French accents are just are unintelligible to me. I'm so bad at it. I'm so bad at intelligibling any accent in French that is not the lady on the GCSE listening exams. Dun dun. The physician is a spy and has informed the soldiers of Barbara and Susan's whereabouts. Before they know what has happened, they have been rearrested and taken back to prison. Knowing full well the connections between his guests, Lemaitre summons the doctor to interrogate Barbara, only to eavesdrop on their conversation. The doctor and Barbara are so pleased to see each other. It's very sweet.
It's really nice. And it's also like, yeah, you really couldn't have just dropped them off, could you, Doctor?
Yeah.
That wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Could not. Whilst all this is happening, Ian is going to meet Leon in an abandoned church crypt. God.
It's good. Actually,
it's good. As he sees Leon, several soldiers step from the shadows and surround Ian. As Leon tells Ian, he's walked right into his trap. Dun dun dun!
Dun.
Amazing.
Really good cliffhanger as well. Yep. So that takes us to episode 5.
A Bargain of Necessity.
A Bargain of Necessity. Another really banger title.
It's all good.
So Leon explains that he's trapped Ian to extract information from him. Ian insists that he's not part of the protection ring that's run by Jules, but Leon does not believe him. Meanwhile, at the concierge, Lemaitre's plan to overhear information during the conversation between the doctor and Barbara comes to fruition when he overhears Barbara whisper the address of Jules's safe house. Once Lemaitre has gone, the doctor convinces the jailer that Barbara is a powerful member of the protection racket and that she could hold the key to every rebel in France. And the only way to get this information is to allow her to walk free and follow her to her rebel alliances.
Incredible.
Very, very, very high deception role from the doctor.
It's very, very good.
The jailer unlocks the door, allowing Barbara to escape.
Can I just comment on the fact that it is pretty much textually acknowledged that Ian is about to get tortured? Like, they just go, yeah, Ian's going to get tortured. Let's go back to what's happening at the conciergerie. Yeah, that's going on. Oh, you're worried about Ian? Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
He'll survive whatever's happening.
I bet you were worried about Ian.
I was extremely worried about Ian. As you know, I'm always worried about him because he is my boy.
As Barbara leaves the prison for Jules' house, Jules returns to find Barbara and Ian gone. Jules goes to the church, where he knew that Ian was to meet Leon, and finds him held captive. Eek. He takes the captives by surprise and kills them both so as to liberate Ian.
This fight scene is quite incomprehensible in the animation, because the animation, they just cut to bizarre camera angles, like every 3 seconds.
Of people falling over
In every scene, they're cutting to weird camera angles. And like, when it's just a conversation, you can kind of follow. But when it's like 7 people in a big fight with guns and swords.
Yeah, I didn't follow this very well.
No. In the book, there's a bit where Ian like hoists himself up on his shackles that he is shackled into and kicks someone in the head. That was quite cool.
Yeah, that sounds very badass.
But yeah, Leon gets killed, and Ian is not having a great time. But he is really? No longer being tortured, so that's good.
Back at the concierge, the doctor tries to trick the jailer again, suggesting that he allow Susan to go free in order to follow her, just as he did with Barbara.
Yeah, the
jailer is...
There is this whole thing where the jailer is like, aren't you supposed to be following Barbara? And the doctor is like, I was under the impression you would be following Barbara. How am I supposed to follow Barbara in this getup? It's great.
Powerful. The jailer is reluctant as he fears retribution from his superiors. These superiors he speaks of are in conversation with one another in Robespierre's chambers. Robespierre tells Lemaitre that he suspects his deputy, Paul Barras, is planning to conspire against him in an upcoming convention, and tells Lemaitre to track Barras the next day to a secret assassination outside the city to gain more information.
More
infiltration and subterfuge.
Assassination? I think you said assassination, but it's not an assassination.
Can you understand why?
Yeah, I do understand why. It's a weird word, let's be honest. This is fun. I really enjoy, as we've said, the subterfuge, and I like, I think that this is historical fact. I'm not, as I say, well up on the French Revolution. The historical context drop is just going to be me going, ah, but, you know, this is fun stuff. And Robespierre, the guy playing Robespierre is great. He's really giving it his all. Mm-hmm.
He is full drama all the time. Mm-hmm. Love it. Ian and Jules return to the safe house and are surprised to see Barbara, who tells them what happened. Ian receives this news with great humour. Conversely, Barbara is disgusted when she hears that Jules has killed Leon.
And they have a proper argument and it made me very sad.
It's really good. Yeah, it is. It's really a really good argument, though.
Yeah, like, Barbara basically uses her history knowledge and is like, look, the revolution did a lot of good in the world and not everyone involved in the revolution is a bad person. And Ian's like, yes, I do understand that. However, Leon did try to kill me, so I can't be sad that he's dead.
Yeah, can't blame. So can't blame at all.
Neither of them is really wrong. And it's just like, oh my God, stop arguing. Stop arguing.
And they do.
And they do, and they apologise to each other, and it's really good. But, you know, it's nice to finally get that nuance 5 episodes in of just being on the side of the, royalists or whatever.
Yeah. Unable to play the same trick on the jailer for the second time, the doctor convinces Susan that she should hide behind the door so that from the outside, the cell she'd remain unseen. Once in position, the doctor pretends that she has escaped. When the jailer opens the door in shock to inspect how this happened, the doctor hits him over the head with a bottle. He does a lot of whacking people in the head this episode.
The jailer has already been hit over the head once this episode, because that's how Ian can escape, is that the jailer has been whacked over the head by Lemaitre. But I don't feel as bad for the jailer, because he did try to assault Barbara, and we are not in favour of that.
Yeah, he doesn't have many redeeming features that we have seen.
No.
As Susan and the doctor make their escape, they're stopped by Lemaitre, who reveals that he has been aware of the doctor's duplicity from the start and has been orchestrating the successive release and recapture of his companions. The doctor denies that he is in disguise, but is forced to take Lemaitre to the safe house as Lemaitre threatens Susan's life unless he does so. Barbara, Ian, and Jules are waiting anxiously for the doctor, but are shocked when he arrives, not with Susan in tow, but with Lemaitre.
God.
Renard announces that the doctor has betrayed them.
And thus we have the end of the animation of the Reign of Terror.
I enjoyed the animation.
It's just, it's so different from all the other ones we've seen so far that it's really... Because, yeah. Like, this is, we've done, what, Fury from the Deep, Power of the Daleks, and the Moon Base. And all of those are, like, Fury from the Deep and the Power of the Daleks are fairly similar. And then the moon base was really different, and it fucked, and it was really good. And this is also really good. It's like, oh, hey. not that Fury and Power were bad per se, but they, because they had to do the whole serial, they definitely had less money per episode.
Yeah, definitely.
It would be interesting to see this one in colour. I do wonder what it would look like.
I want to see the Doctor's hat in colour.
Yeah, I mean, it's in colour on the cover of the
I know, it's so good.
It's very, very good. And obviously it's the tricolour, it's bleu, blanc, rouge, you know, and it's very fun.
It would also be really fun to see, like, a historical in bright colours.
Yeah. God, Marco Polo. Marco Polo animation. When?
Ironic that people shout Marco and Polo to find each other when they're lost, and yet Marco Polo itself is lost to time forever.
I know. Maybe one day when we go on our field trip.
When we
trip.
Go to Singapore.
Yeah, our Singapore field trip. God. Yeah. I just really, really enjoyed the serial. Like, the whole serial. Episode 5, I think, is pretty good because it does have... It kind of justifies the fact that they've gone back to the stupid conciergerie again. You're like, oh my god. But at least this time Lemaitre is like planning something, so you kind of get it.
Yeah, and it sort of does excuse it. No, we're not just using the same set over and over.
Yeah, episode 6, Prisoners of Conciergerie. Now, by this point, they're not really prisoners anymore. I think they might have mixed up some titles there.
Still.
Lemaitre states that he has been orchestrating the releases and recapture of the Doctor's companions. When Ian questions why he would do this, Lemaitre reveals he is James Stirling. Oh my god.
Gasp.
Isn't James Stirling
you
the name
have seen
of...
this coming.
Isn't that Mark Shepherd in Leverage as James Stirling? I know it's spelt differently, but that's all I could think about. For like the whole...
One second, I think Joel might be downstairs. He's just watched all of Leverage.
God.
Joel? Joel?
Yeah, James Stirling.
Cool, okay, no. Sorted.
Joel!
Well, I just needed, if he was downstairs, to know that I was actually requesting. Yeah.
Sterling was placed...
I had to put a silly voice so it wouldn't sound like I was just yelling.
Yes. Sterling was placed deep undercover and was supposed to intercept Webster at the prison, but was too late because Webster got shot or stabbed or something and bled out, which is why he died. That was my impression, anyway. Ian relays Webster's message.
I just thought he was ill.
Yeah, he got stabbed. Ian relays Webster's message that Sterling should return to England immediately. The spy agrees, but presses Ian for more detail on Webster's last hours. Initially, Ian can't remember any details, but when Sterling begins to talk about the fact he was called to follow Barras for Robespierre, Ian recalls the words Barras, meeting, and the sinking ship. Sterling recalls that this is the name of an inn on the Calais Road, and that they realise that this is where the conspiracy against the First Deputy will take place. The drama! So good.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
So good. I think this is around when they're talking to Jules and Jules discusses why he is a revolutionary or like anti-revolutionary because they just kind of assumed he was aristocracy and he's like, no, I'm not aristocracy. I just think murder is bad. And you're like, yeah, I also think murder is bad. I understand
that's
that,
Jules. That's fair.
It's very fun. But yeah, so it is decided that Jules, Ian and Barbara be placed there undercover in order to gain information from the meeting. Yes! Undercover work. So fun. It's like, they all get to dress up again. Very, very good. And Ian and Barbara get to be together. Also good.
Which is very good indeed.
Yes. Jules disguised as a guest and Ian and Barbara disguised as landlord and serving woman are undercover at the inn. The actual landlord is tied up in the basement. I just find it...
We've all been
I'm
there.
I'm sorry, I find it so funny. It's like... Jules is like, man, I hope that I tied up the innkeeper well enough down there. Like alternate universe where he just storms out and is like, where is that man that knocked me over the head? Don't you know that it doesn't actually knock people out? When Barras appears, he seems unsure at first, but soon warms to the place. Eventually, a young man enters and Ian and Barbara don't know who it is. However, they soon discover it is Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh my god, that Napoleon!
Ian and Barbara are so excited about this, and it's wonderful.
It's so cute.
Through a hole Ian made in the wall, Ian and Barbara hear Barras seek to persuade the young general to take the mantle of leadership after the overthrow of Robespierre as one of three consuls. Napoleon urges Barras to topple Robespierre, but warns him that if this fails to happen, he will deny this meeting ever took place. The guy playing Napoleon is also great. There's some very good characters.
Yes, he has a very Napoleonish face as well.
Yeah, quite square-jawed. The following day, Jules and Ian speed off to stop Robespierre's imprisonment, an act which Barbara finds amusing because she knows history cannot be changed. And she says, I learned that with the Aztecs. And you're like, yes, referencing old serials!
There's quite a lot of referencing in this one, yeah, which is nice.
I guess it's because it's the end of the series, or series one.
Yeah.
By the time Jules and Ian get there, the coup against Robespierre has begun and the tyrant has been shot in the mouth before being seized himself and sent to the conciergerie. The fucking... This is pretty brutal. And it's even more brutal in the novelization because Ian Martyr loves gore.
Oh, boy.
While this is happening, the doctor reaches the prison where he outwits the jailer by convincing him that Lemaître has been captured as a traitor and that the jailer is an associate of his and will soon be thrown into prison himself. The doctor then wins the jailer around by being lenient with him. He suggests that the prison be cleared in preparation for the huge influx of traitors that will be brought, ensuring that Susan is freed in order to escape with them. Yes!
Mm-hmm.
As they leave through one door, the bleeding Robespierre is brought in by another, his body broken and his rule ended. Soon he will be guillotined himself. God.
It's quite intense.
Yeah. The escape chain now demonstrates itself to its best effect and smuggles several people out of Paris. Sterling will head for Calais and thence to England. Jules and Jean will lie low as they measure the future now that Robespierre has fallen, and the Doctor and his companions are to return to the TARDIS in the woods near Paris, reflecting on another brush with history and their role within it, especially the fact that history has a way of remaining resilient to human change and that their journeys in the future are up to the stars. The end.
Yes!
To remain in this universe, the creature would have to reverse its polarity.
I think you enjoyed it more than I did.
Yes, I did.
It's all a good time.
It was very good to me.
I think it ticked a lot of your boxes.
It did, yes. And I didn't, I when you were like, oh, I'm excited now, I didn't really want to be like, I don't think you'll like it as much as I will, as much as I did. But like, I didn't think that you would.
I still had a good time.
Yeah.
I went in knowing that like, it's not, I struggle with the longer 60 stories. So I knew it wouldn't be one of my all-time favourites, but yeah. I enjoyed it.
I think it's paced a lot better
There's
than other
really
six
good
parters
moments
of
in
the
there
era.
As well. God, absolutely.
Or seven parters. The Daleks. It helps that it has
I still
a,
haven't been able to finish
yeah,
the Daleks.
It helps that it has a really strong narrative through line, I think, where it goes, well, we're going to start here and end here. And these are the events
And it's got
that
a lot
occur.
Of really good, yeah, it's got some really good moments as well.
Yeah.
Like, even if I was getting a bit, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Lots of good dynamics going on and some very strong side yeah. characters. Always good.
Yes, definitely.
Yes.
An apple a day keeps the, No, never mind.
Let's talk about our guy, our old guy.
Our little grandpa goblin.
Our little grandpa goblin. He is just chaotic in this serial. Just...
Truly chaotic.
It's such an odd one. I think William Hartnell is having a great time with this, even though he didn't like the director and he was very stressed and everyone was very stressed. The Doctor himself is having a great time. We've already discussed him committing murder, but I do like him being a warrior on behalf of the chain gang. I thought that was very nice. He's like, stop treating these men badly. And the chain gang leader is like, no. So the Doctor whacks him on the head with a spade. Although everyone's going to get caught without papers, presumably. Apparently they're all tax dodgers. And it's like, well... In Paris and France, I assume that means that they don't have any money.
yeah.
It's kind of tricky.
Yeah.
You've got a very loud note in here, I noticed.
His hat. Mm. His hat. Mm-hmm. We must discuss his hat.
Mm-hmm.
He just wears a fun little hat. It's very feathery.
It's a very fun little hat.
I wish that we got more prop hats in this show.
Yeah.
This is a perfect one.
Genuinely.
He wears it frequently.
Yes. I was watching it at the end, like the scene at the end where they're all in the TARDIS and kind of getting out of their garb. And I was like, man, it would be fun if the Doctor just went into the TARDIS wardrobe and just found this hat and put it on for a second and you went, oh, hey, it's the hat. But it's like, it's a fun enough hat on its own that it would be a fun moment even if you haven't seen The Reign of Terror.
Which I imagine a lot of people have.
Probably
seen.
Not, which is a shame because I think it is good. And I really want more people to watch the historicals because then more of them would get animated. Come on.
Yeah.
We're missing so many of them. Where's the massacre at St. Bartholomew's Eve? Where's the myth makers?
We'll have to find them.
We will.
It is our quest.
We will.
Now.
It is our quest.
If
I catch rheumatism, apologies won't cure it. Good line.
He's got lots of snark this episode.
Yeah, he's kind of becomes the comic relief guy.
Which is really, he does it really fucking well.
He
as
does,
well.
Yeah. He seems to be having a very, very good time, as we mentioned.
I really like his little speech at the end of the episode as well about the futures and the stars, aren't we journeyed?
Sorry, I've just seen a tweet about how Bill and Heather
is called
are named
and
after
Heather.
William Hartnell and his wife.
Yep, I just saw that as well.
That's so cute. Anyway, sorry, it was vaguely relevant because we're talking about William Hartnell. He's just very, very good at being the Doctor. Like, he really, he's just so good. And I don't know that he's necessarily underappreciated, but not enough people have watched, I think, more of his serials, partly because some of them are lost, but like he develops so much over the course of the show into this lovely, like, snarky old grandpa, and you're like, oh yeah, that's our guy, that's the Doctor. And I find that so nice that he managed to originate it so successfully before anyone really knew what the show was going to be like.
Yeah, and it's also, you've got those themes of abandonment issues with how snarkily and coarsely he's about to let Barbara and Ian go at the beginning, then literally just like
hugging,
sneaking about getting them back, and yeah, it's
very, very sweet. They're like going from Keys of Marinus to this again, you can see that development from, I think it went Keys of Marinus, then Aztecs, then Sensorites, then this. So they've had a decent amount more time together, and it's just so lovely. It's so lovely. I love them. I love them so much.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad we have so much more of them together to look forward to.
When do they leave?
In the Chase, which I think is the end of the
Chase. It's end of season 2. Yeah.
It's like,
that's quite a lot. That's a long run, especially by like these standards.
Yeah, although, you know, they didn't they didn't have the format of the revolving door of companions, and then suddenly it became the revolving door of companions after they left.
Yes.
It's very interesting. But yeah, what is, I don't really have anything else to say about him. He's just wonderful in this one. He's very, very fun and snarky and lovely.
Yeah, I think if somebody needed to start somewhere with one and just have something that encapsulates a lot of different aspects of his character, this would be a good shout for
him. And also, it's like, it's a good serial. It's not the best serial, so you're not setting yourself up for disappointment.
I have to go.
Now look, if you're going to be in trouble, you'll need me to look after you.
Me too.
But you don't understand.
Go on, just go on.
I just love them so much, Aim. I love them so much.
I know.
I love them so much.
I love how much you love them.
I saw them on screen and I was like, oh, that's my friends. That's my fucking friends. I love them so much. Like, it's fully parasocial, but for fictional characters from 50 years ago. I want to be besties with Barbara and Ian. I want to give Susan a hug. It's fine.
Are you okay?
No, I think we should save Barbara discussion for Wife City, because like, she is so Wife City in the serial, it's not even funny. She turns Paris into Wife City. Ian is, film insert Ian is having a miserable time. Like, he just has the most miserable time. There's all these really dramatic shots of him bathed in like spotlight, like staring sadly into the camera, and you're like, oh Ian.
You did describe him as a little meow meow.
He is a poor little meow meow, but he's a bit too actiony to be a perpetual poor little meow meow.
But he has his moments.
Yes. As mentioned, he's having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, but he's still delighted every time he sees Barbara and Susan. They hold hands, they hug. In the book, I think he kisses her on the forehead and I screamed a little bit.
Oh,
I think that occurred. It was all very, very good. That also happens in the Crusade novelization. The Crusade novelization also features them actually kissing, so like, that's another reason I want the Crusade to be animated, so I can read the novelization.
You can just read the novelization
But like,
you do know this.
Then I wouldn't be able to discuss it on the podcast immediately. I must discuss things
That's
at all times.
That's very true.
But yeah, he's just very, he has a very stressful time, and then he gets to have a couple of glasses of wine to calm down, and then he goes and gets tortured, and you're like, oh Ian.
You see, there are other circumstances where that could sound like a fun evening out, but not in this.
No, like, he gets chained up, and then the next episode, like, Barbara notices that his wrists are like, you know, cut up. And in the book, explicitly they're all torn up and like bleeding, so Jules has to like rip up a handkerchief and bind them up, and you're like, oh my god. He's just not having a good time.
I think somebody at some point, I think they also comment on like Susan and Barbara's hands after trying to like scramble up the cell as well.
They get horrible blisters on their hands. It's like,
The lasting consequences. Ugh.
Yeah.
Poor babies.
Yeah. Physical trauma, mental trauma, there's a lot going on. You've got a note, which I definitely appreciate.
Oh, can we appreciate that he tells the truth? So when he's being tortured at the start of episode 5, they ask him how he got here, and they're like, tell the truth, and he just does. Yeah. He's like, I got here in a box with three of my friends.
And when I left England, it was 1963.
It's so good. It's genuinely just like, I love Ian.
Yeah, he's doing his best. He's very stressed and very unhappy in a very bad place, and he's still like, I'm going to be a sarcastic little man, and I really admire that about him. And also, when he's being the innkeeper, he does a voice that is extremely inscrutable. It's kind of like, It's kind of like he's trying to do a West Country accent and failing.
I think it's beautiful. It's I would like good. To hear more of Ian's accent work.
Yes, I would love to hear more of his accent work. I think William Russell is a genius and I love him. But yeah, that's Ian on his own. And then we have Susan, who is having an extremely bad time cereal.
Poor Susan. She just doesn't get a break. I can't imagine she would ever want to go back to France again in any context.
No, it's like it. Oh, we forgot to mention this is one's favourite historical period, according to Susan. You're like, oh, Doctor, why do you like Cute. This so much? So much change in such a short time. Yeah, I noticed that the info text described her as excessively whiny. It's not excessive. She's ill and sad and being like trapped in a horrible dungeon.
I'm pretty sure I added that note, but I appreciate it. Like, you also found that not fair.
It's not fair.
It's just not fair.
She's textually a teen at this point in the show. Obviously, later on we discover she was, you know, 80 or whatever. I don't think it's ever explicitly said, but...
But also, like, can we just appreciate that put anybody in that situation, they're going to have a fucking moan about
Yeah, her. Jesus. And she was ill and... Terrible. Cute. And then at the very, very, very end, when they're all having a debrief in the TARDIS, she puts on one's hat and it goes over her eyes and it's very cute.
Yeah. Oh, it is very cute. I wish she had more to do, but also a lot was happening.
Barbara and Susan also have a very good double act going on in this one.
Yeah, they do. Especially like Barbara being like the mom friend all around. Yeah,
she's like a very kind aunt to her niece Susan, who is having a bad time. They get immediately captured all the time and you're like, oh no, I like Barbara always attempting to have an escape plan. I think that's very practical of her.
It's very exactly how she would react to that situation.
She is an extremely practically minded person and I really admire that about her. If she could have been, she would have been wearing sensible shoes and a pair of trousers.
She would, yep.
She's great. She's like pro Sans Culottes because she wants to be wearing the trousers.
Do you want to have a little diatribe about Barbara and Ian? I just sit and enjoy.
The ultimate girl boss slash male wife pairing in Doctor Who history.
God.
The Goals. Originator, if you will. As we already discussed, he says, very pretty, mamselle. And I'm like, oh my God, he thinks she's pretty. The hairstyle's a bit modern though. Very fun. They have a lot of standing too close. Always good. Always good when they're standing too close together. I go, yes, that's them. Like, they're stood there staring lovingly into each other's eyes and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
They
share the personal
space. Yes, they do share personal space. They have a lovely reunion hug when they see each other at the house, as mentioned. This is an animated hug and I do want to know what they did in the original, but I guess we'll never know for sure. And then we have the argument that they have, which made me very sad, but was also very good.
Good line, the check your history books, Ian, before you decide what people deserve.
He says Leon got what he deserved, and it's a bit like, Ian, you're in a very bad place, but also not the best thing to say. Yeah, it's like, I understand the lack of empathy, but, you know, it's a whole thing. And Jules is also somewhat apologetic. I think there's a nice bit where they're talking it out, Jules comes in, and Barbara's like, I'm sorry for what I said, and he goes, you were thinking of Leon the man, not Leon the traitor, and you're like, oh my God! Aww. They've all gotta do stuff with their morals, and it's really interesting.
I also really appreciate that they did at least try and touch on that in the
like,
story.
Like, it's not the most...
It could have been very easy to
it's
not.
It's not the most even-handed thing, but it should be noted that Robespierre was bad.
Actually.
Yeah, and also Jules and John are explicitly like, we don't want a military dictatorship. So we know that they're not, like, you know, they're trying to be democratic, just not, you know, whatever they've got. Like, they're currently stuck under Robespierre, who is killing everybody. And they're like, we need to have a slightly more democratic solution to this situation. But yeah, they talk it out and acknowledge the person's position and they say sorry, they're married, they're in love. And then the final reunion when they're at the very end and they hold hands so tenderly and it's so cute.
It's lovely.
I don't know why they affect me so much, but I just adore them. I have my Barbara and Ian fan art, like I can see it right across from me. I can see them and I smile every time I see it. Oh.
Every time you talk about them, it makes me happy.
Yes, they are just perfect. They are perfect to me. Speaking of love, though.
On your knees, Doctor.
Yes, in Gay Paris, il y a les autres shows... I don't know what a normal term for gay is in French.
No. I did ask one of my friends who grew up in a French-speaking country to check it, and they were like, there must be a gay a word for gay in
apparently
French.
Apparently, it's
that isn't just
apparently
gay.
It's you either say homosexuel or just gay, and I'm like, yeah, gay. Gay is yeah is better. but yeah, les choses intéressantes pour moi parce que je suis gay aussi. Ian being dropped into a gay doomed prison romance with Webster for like 2 hours, and you're like, what the fuck? What's going on here?
The way that he cradled Webster as he died could not
it
be straight.
It could not be straight. It was like they were so
if
close, and he was listening so carefully, and like
it was so tender.
Again, it's that fucking like you can cradle your war buddy if he's bleeding out on the battlefield. It's really that quote.
Yeah, it's
Ian
does not have straight.
Ian
vibes.
Does not have straight vibes. Ian is a funky little bisexual.
Yeah.
The Ian Leon interrogation scene is inherently homoerotically charged. Like, it's negatively homoerotically charged. It's not great, but, like, it's ionized.
Negative charge of homoerotic.
It's ionized. But, like, it's very gay. Like, he gets up close to him, and, like, Ian is, like, chained up. It's got, like, a kind of weird bondage vibe that is very odd for Doctor Who. It was more like watching the fucking Avengers or something.
I bet you that nobody working on it read that into it, or if they did, they enjoyed it and kept quiet.
It's also we must acknowledge that being French is kind of gay. It's kind of gay to be French.
Is this okay to say in the year of our Lord 2021/2, depending on when this episode
comes
out?
What, that it's kind of gay to be French? Well, no, because I speak French and my name is French and I'm gay.
Oh, yeah, no, that's fair. That's true, actually. My surname does trace back to France.
It is a negative stereotype in the UK that being French is kind of fruity. But we can always reclaim that as people that speak French. No.
I don't speak French. I just admire
my surname is the word French, so it totally counts. all the French people I know are gay.
Mine is a French word. Mine's a French word that translates as manservant to the nuns.
That's incredible. I bet you wish you could be a manservant to the nuns.
Oh, you fucking know it.
But yeah, so all of the French men in this serial, for better or worse, do seem kind of gay, except the jailer who fucking sucks, and the
dude with the road.
The chain gang guy, yeah, he also sucks. Yeah. But all of the prisoners, they could have gone off to form like a commune, you never know.
Maybe that was their goal for revolutionary France, making French being literally kind of gay, just having a very queer country.
Indeed. James Sterling works best alone, happened. But you can tell he wants some companionship and he's sad about it. And you're like, oh yeah, this guy knew he couldn't get married because he's gay, so he's gone off and formed a life of celibate servitude to his country. And you're like, no, you can be gay too. It's okay, Sterling.
Hey, we don't know. Maybe he hadn't. Like, he was very good at double lives. He could have had somebody.
Well, we do say that Webster was a good friend.
A good friend.
And Ian and Sterling kind of.
And we know that Webster's. Yeah, Sterling definitely has those.
Yeah.
Were he alive today, he would spend a lot of time on Grindr vibes.
Yeah, he's also very dramatic, which, as we've established before, is queer coding in our eyes.
Is that because we are very dramatic?
Yes, absolutely.
Who can say?
I also, when I was reading the novelisation, I capped a couple of interactions between Jean and Jules that made me feel, you know, a little bit kind of way. And it is fairly platonic for, like, you know, French people in the 1700s. However, I will be interpreting it however I like, because it's a Doctor Who novelisation and it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things. But yes, yeah, so Barbara says that Barbara's asking them about times that they've risked their lives. Jean says, many times, with a look of intense dedication. Not all Frenchmen can bear to stand by while innocent people are led to the slaughter. Jules has saved many lives. Jules smiled wryly and shrugged. It appears that my luck is running out. Luck, Jean protested. Not luck, but bravery and selflessness. But Jules would hear no more. Blushing with embarrassment, he pointed to the door.
It's very much I watched The Old Guard for the first time a couple of months back.
Oh, such a good movie.
And it's very much that he is not my boyfriend.
Oh my God.
He is all of
oh
that
my
and
God.
More.
And,
oh, don't my fucking
talk to me
God,
about
slay
Joe
me,
and Nikki.
Slay me.
Don't talk to me about
oh
Joe and Nikki. Oh my God.
I haven't processed this properly. I have not had.
Okay, you can talk to me. You can talk to me about Joe and Nikki after we finish recording the podcast.
Oh yeah, this is an Art Old Guard podcast.
Yes, unfortunately.
It?
And then also,
oh boy, sorry, I don't know where that
then,
came from.
Then also there's a bit that's just like, Jean embraced Jules. You'll hear from me in 3 days at the latest, he promised. Jules kissed him on both cheeks. Take care, Jean. And you're like, oh, I know they did this anyway.
They're in love.
But still, they're like, you know, is it, fellas, is it gay to work together to rescue people from the guillotine? They're queering societal expectations of revolutionary France by not letting people get guillotined.
Which we are here for.
But yeah, it's a very fun episode. It has certain homoerotic vibes. I really, you know, like, it's sort of breadcrumbs, but they are actually there for once, unlike previous episodes where we're kind of literally scrabbling.
I think we found them really well this time. I think, yeah, there's a lot of queerness in this episode.
Shall we
I'm trying to think if there's any more queerness, but I didn't write any down while I was
well
watching,
there's some so. Absolute queerness, which is me at Barbara Wright, my fucking wife. That's my wife.
Oh, sure. Lots of people.
And there's a woman.
A woman. A woman? Hey.
This is another way in which I am Ian Chesterton Kin, I guess. Yes, allow me to shepherd you into the back of a horse cart as we make our way towards Wife City.
They're not going to cut our heads off there,
no,
are
they? No, of course not. We're going to get to meet our various wives, our many wives. She is just so beautiful and so smart and so competent, and she's so brave, and everything that she does, I just think, oh my God, Barbara, you're perfect to me. Like, she gets frustrated and she gets sad and she gets disheartened and she still like gets back up and is like, yes, okay, I can do this. And you're like, oh my God, Barbara, that's my fucking wife. It's my wife.
I just absolutely, I can never wife her as much as you wife her. I don't think that's actually possible.
Yeah. Are you wifing her, though?
Oh, yeah. My concern here is that I'm actually not good enough.
No! That's a very negative self-talk, and we won't have that on this podcast, Dame. You are wonderful.
Thank you. That's what we say. She's just so good.
She is so good.
Also, she does look very pretty in her French
Yes. Very pretty, mademoiselle. Outfit. And it's fun later when she puts on, like, the maid outfit and has the little bonnet.
So cute.
And Ian also has a hat on, and you're like, yes, fun hats.
Just everybody in Doctor Who should wear a fun hat all the time.
She's just so good. Like, I really love that they made the first two companions be the ones who kind of, you know, teach the audience about history and science, because it means they get to be competent and intelligent on their own terms. And obviously other companions get to as well, but as it moved further away from educational Doctor Who, it sort of forgot that that was the initial role that the companions had.
Yeah, I had another point to jump off that with. What was it? Yes, that was it. So the Doctor doesn't seem to be the driving force of the story. It really is Ian and Barbara and their escapades more so than what the Doctor's doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of what's a primary and secondary storyline, I can't think of that many stories where the Doctor isn't part of the A-plot.
Yeah, it's really interesting. He's kind of moving things around behind the scenes, and he's involved in sort of the actual upper level, like, French government manipulations, but also he's in significantly less of the serial, and you're like, oh yeah, okay. We get some plot movement. Yeah. We get some Barbara and Ian getting to, you know, move about.
Have trauma.
Oh my God. We're going to have to start like a running checklist of all the things they're going to need therapy about.
Yes.
Also, very quick wife segment for Danielle, the beautiful sister of Jules, who doesn't appear very much, but is very pretty and is, you know, she's doing stuff.
A named woman.
Yeah, a named woman. She gets to be suspicious of Leon, and like, he tries to talk to her and she's like essentially telling him to fuck off with her eyes. It's great.
It's very good. She's powerful.
Yeah, she is powerful. That's wives. That's wives.
That's, what a t-shirt that just says that.
Put it on your Redbubble, babe.
I will. I'll use the colours on our branding.
Yes.
All right.
Today's science fiction so often becomes tomorrow's science fact.
We don't have massive amounts of behind the scenes today, mostly because I was tired and we've got a lot of other stuff still to talk about. So I thought let's not trunk it up too much longer. So this is the first Doctor Who story to feature location filming. They used a body double because Hartnell wasn't in a play, as we discussed. But yeah, that's a first for the show. And this is just sort of like chronology of how they got the episodes they have and how things that were lost were lost. Only the first, second, third and sixth episodes exist in the BBC archives as 60mm telerecordings. Prisoners of Concierge was returned by a private collector in May 1982. Prints of all four existing episodes were recovered from a Cypriot television station in 1985, which included a superior print of Prisoners of Concierge. The station did originally have all six episodes, but their copies of The Tyrant of France and A Bargain of Necessity were destroyed in a bombing strike during the Cypriot Civil War. The amount of culture, art, content we have lost.
Yeah.
Not just Doctor Who, just globally.
It's really, really sad.
As a result of war is wild.
I think it should be noted, obviously, as a Doctor Who podcast, we mostly focus on the missing Doctor Who episodes. There's missing episodes of so much media, which it is a great loss to mankind that we don't have it. And I think it's very, very sad.
Legitimately, when you consider the development of stories and access to media,
especially like the loss of silent movies that were made in various other countries. Yeah. And you're like, I don't even watch silent movies that much, but I know that we need them.
Yeah, that's like just from a historical perspective. Yeah. It also massively homogenizes the media we do have access to when such large swathes are taken, which is bad.
It's very bad.
This story was a replacement for a six-part story by David Whittaker, which would have been set at the time of the Spanish Armada, which would have been
cool.
It
would have been. Actually, David Whittaker is a great writer.
I would have liked that. Yeah. And William Russell originally suggested the idea of a story set during the French Revolution.
Fucking great suggestion.
Thanks, William Russell. Yeah.
David Whittaker wrote Edge of Destruction, The Rescue, The Crusade, Power of the Daleks, Evil of the Daleks, The Enemy of the World, The Wheel in Space, and The Ambassadors of Death. Very cool stuff.
Of the ones I've seen of that list, I've really liked them.
So
I cannot wait till we get to discuss Enemy of the World.
I'm very excited for it.
Holy shit, it's a personal fave. It's not necessarily good by our standards today, but it's still good.
But it is.
It's still good. It's still good.
I have a tiny amount of information about the Armada one. It was going to be called The New Armada. An unproduced 1965 six-part Doctor Who adventure story. So I think it must have been pitched and then eventually he developed it. Written by script editor and writer David Whittaker for the first Doctor Stephen and Dodo, and was considered as parts of season 2 and 3 of the show. The Doctor Stephen and Dodo land in 16th century Spain in the midst of a war against the Spanish Armada and unite Privateer of England Sir Francis Drake to stop the Armada fleet.
That would have been badass.
As someone who grew up in the Southwest, I spent my entire primary school life learning about Sir Francis Drake, so I would have loved to be able to watch a Doctor Who serial that had Francis Drake in it.
Well, we know we've got the... From the next season of New Who, there is pirate looking.
Oh my
episodes.
God.
They could be doing
oh my
it.
God. God.
Could happen.
Yeah, we should mention we're recording this the week that it has been announced that Chibbers and Jodie Whittaker are leaving the show.
So, very, very sad
Jodie Whittaker is leaving. I'm very sad Jodie Whittaker is leaving. She is one of many good Whittakers involved in Doctor Who, for example, David Whittaker.
But it's a show that is about inherently
the
nature of change.
I know. They better have a fucking woman for the next one. Like, come on, guys. You can't go back now. It better be Jo Martin.
Friend of the show. I was going to say, friend of the show, Dom, keeps pitching Jo Martin. And
he is correct.
Right. Thank you. Joel has just brought me coffee.
Thanks, Joel.
So, yeah, we support Dom's campaign to get Jo Martin as the next Doctor.
Yes, we do support that.
we also support... Alex Siddig and
yes,
Andrew
we
Robinson.
Do absolutely support that. So. If it's not going to be a woman, Alexander then Siddig, that's the only option.
We're very open-minded people here, but those are the two options.
Yeah, the other behind-the-scenes stuff, I watched the behind-the-scenes making-of documentary on the DVD, which is very fun. Every transition they do with a noise like ka-thunk, because it's the guillotine chopping someone's head off.
Fucking love the documentaries.
Yeah, there's a bit with... Mm. They've got Caroline Ford, Tim something, who was the production assistant... they talk about the bit where Henrik Hirsch, who directed it, collapsed during the filming of episode 3. He was very, very stressed out. He was a Hungarian refugee who'd become a television director, and he had never directed a TV serial before. And he didn't anticipate how stressful it would be. And he collapsed during the filming of episode 3, and then they had to finish the filming of episode 3 with an unholy combination of, like, the production manager, Verity Lambert, came down, the director of photography, like... No one knows who directed episode 3 of this serial.
Yep. Yeah. There's several people.
Yes.
Credited.
Yes.
In it.
It's an interesting moment. And then they also Caroline Ford talked about how there was supposed to be kind of an insert shot where the Doctor looks through some trees and he sees a little he sees Paris in the distance, and they made a tiny model of Paris that was then not used in the filming, but Caroline Ford liked it so much that the prop department gave it to her. And then her cleaning lady accidentally destroyed it,
just knocked it off the top
of
the wardrobe.
Oh my god.
Wild. Yeah,
we've already discussed how there was a body double for William Hartnell, and that William Russell went on holiday. I think that's all the behind-the-scenes stuff I have. I might have a quick look in inside the TARDIS, the worlds of Doctor Who, as I always do. I still haven't found my physical copy of it. It's somewhere. It's somewhere.
Can't wait for it just to appear from, like, the
bathroom. Yeah, oh my god, I found my keys.
Where were they?
They were...
Go on. I have been waiting on the edge of my seat for a week to hear where you found your keys.
They were. You're going to really enjoy this. We were in the board games, right? We have a bookshelf of board games in the living room, and we also had a box of board games. And I was reorganizing the board game shelf because my grandparents delivered my piano and also a bunch of board games that needed to be integrated into the board game collection. So I decided, oh, we'll swap all the little ones from the box out for some of the big ones from the shelf. And as we were doing that, we looked in the box, and at the bottom of the box were my keys. Wow. I hadn't even opened the box. I hadn't opened the box.
Wow.
So I don't know how they got in
there. How long have you been in this flat?
We've lived there for like 3 weeks.
Have you had any other...
Ghosts?
Ghosts. Yeah, that's what I'm going
Not
for.
Not that I know of.
Okay, it's early days. Make sure you're nice to them. Just let them know you're about, and they shouldn't cause you too much harm.
Okay, here is a piece of information from inside the TARDIS about...
Oh, I thought you were going to say more about the ghosts
about
in your
the serial. So apparently there's quantitative versus qualitative evidence about whether historicals were less popular, and the answer seems to be that they weren't actually that much less popular. The issue is that the children really enjoyed it, and they enjoyed the historicals. The adults who knew what the history was were like, this is inaccurate. And they didn't like it. Two graduate archaeologists complained of the completely unnecessary vagueness and numerous archaeological howlers in the first story. And the honorary secretary of the Napoleon I Society took issue with the liberties taken in Dennis Spooner's script for The Reign of Terror.
Wow.
That which children see on television will stick in their minds for many years, despite the lectures of teachers and the lessons learned from the textbooks. The BBC's action in this case is deeply to be regretted.
Wow. Powerful. Okay. Intense. Thank you, Mary Whitehouse, for your opinion.
Yeah. It was interesting. The series, historical Doctor Who tended to focus on periods of the past that were taught in schools and would therefore be familiar to children, but the series did not exclusively privilege British history. Unlike the modern British national curriculum, it's fine. I'm not mad.
Is it
Except
fine?
Except for the ways that I am mad. Like, I'm very mad about the history curriculum in this country. It's If you're going to say we can teach the Indus Valley, can you please provide us with some resources for teaching the Indus Valley, or everyone's going to teach the fucking Egyptians? And there's nothing wrong with teaching the Egyptians. The issue is that you keep claiming you're being diverse, but you're not providing the resources. Government. I did a presentation at uni about the lack of diversity in the history curriculum.
Yeah. Fair.
And I was right to say it. But yeah, I guess that's our behind the scenes stuff. It seems to have had a slightly troubled production, but by the time they got back to the studios that they liked, they all calmed down a little
bit. Had a better time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Critique time?
Historical time?
Yeah. Historical segment. Shit, historical context drop.
Yeah.
So.
You can't rewrite history. Not one line.
So my understanding of this, so there was the French Revolution, which toppled the monarchy, and they eventually beheaded Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette and all of their family. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to lead into this kind of democratic utopia, in the sense that, you know, they abolished a bunch of laws that had been unfair, and they technically decriminalized homosexuality, although there was still a social stigma. But however, people then viewed Paris as like a kind of gay haven from the cruel laws of the UK. So, like, we support that. And maybe a reason why the UK has a stereotype of France being kind of gay. Who knows? So there was this area. Robespierre, who was obviously a real historical figure, kind of started out as like a hero of the revolution and then became kind of a despot who was executing people left and right. And eventually people got sick of it and executed him. It doesn't seem that there was actually much of a plot between Napoleon and Barras, historically, as far as I'm aware. Which I guess is why they have Napoleon say that he will deny the meeting ever took place.
Powerful, okay.
Didn't do French history at school, so I don't know a lot about it. My sister once wrote an essay for her history teacher, just off the cuff on her own time, connecting the French Revolution directly to the outbreak of World War One.
Your sister sounds
my
very
sister
powerful
is very powerful. She has a degree in history as well, and a master's in library science, and is paid better than anyone in my family, essentially. She's doing great. I also want to just quickly reminisce about the time I saw Napoleon's grave, which is currently in Les Invalides in Paris, which is a military history museum that my dad took us to when we went to France when I was in year five. And we spent 3 hours there. Three hours.
Do you remember anything?
I remember that there was a gun that had like 6 barrels. And there were lots of... My dad told me the difference between matchlocks, flintlocks, and wheel locks. And I remember Napoleon's grave was actually... Because my sister wanted to do this thing where she laid flowers at the foot of the grave in reference to a book. Sorry, there's some big ravens outside or something. God, those are big birds. sorry, I got distracted there.
Big birds?
Very big birds. But no, my sister wanted to do this thing. I think it's one of the Chalet School books. She was going to lay flowers at the foot of Napoleon's grave, but it turns out that it's 1 indoors and 2 behind a big rope, so you can't get close to it. Napoleon's remains are inside 15 coffins, like one inside the other, like a kind of weird Matryoshka doll. It's a massive coffin, and then way down on the inside is him, because he got reinterred from St. Helens, where he was exiled too. I remember being extremely bored, like extremely bored for most of it. But fair. That's life when you're 10 at a military history museum with your dad.
Yeah.
The rest of the week we were at Disneyland Paris.
The Tank Museum a lot.
The Tank Museum is fucking great though. I went on a school trip there recently.
It always makes me so sad.
It is very sad, but it's also great. We went there on a school trip recently. I say recently, I was in my second year of university. And we had a great time. We got to do like a bunch of like little activities. There was a bunch of artifacts they brought out for us to look at, and then I got to look at all the tanks, and I was like, ooh, but we didn't get to focus on the World War I tanks, which is what I was actually interested in, sadly. I find the history of tanks very interesting. I don't find modern tanks interesting at all, and in fact, I don't think we should have any, but I find the development of them very interesting. Have you been to the have you been to the helicopter museum?
I think that was great.
We did like a little experiment there once, I think.
Okay. Nice.
Like, where you had to try and make a helicopter out of paper.
Do we want to create a secondary museum podcast where we
go to the weirdest museums in Britain? Please. We can go to the Pencil Museum.
Cool. I fucking love the Pencil Museum.
I haven't been. I've been to...
Oh my God, you're in for
I've
a treat.
I've been to an extremely
really
weird wax museum on the Isle of Wight, where it had all of these Victorian curiosities, right? Like the Fiji mermaid and stuff, and a two-headed calf.
Mm.
What other museums? We nearly went to a kazoo museum in America, but we did not quite make it. We went to a carousel museum. I just love museums. Just fucking love museums. Maybe we can go to the Space Museum one day.
Yes.
I'm talking Doctor Who Space Museum, but I have been to the Air and Space one. Is it Lancaster, there's one?
There's one near Lancaster. There's also the Air and Space one in Washington,
D.C. I've been there. Really good. The one in Lancaster is great, though, because they have a never-ending loop showing of De la Lune à la Terre. Just on loop.
Nice.
It's great. Historical context aside, I did Google when were coat hangers invented, because there are coat hangers in the tailor shop scene. and the answer is possibly in the late 1700s, because Thomas Jefferson allegedly had something he hung his coats on. But the modern design that they're using there was not created until like the 1930s. So slight historical anachronism. I don't blame them, though, on that front.
I mean, I love that you looked that up. That's dedication
to the
cause.
Yeah, I had to. Also, just as a note, I did spot a jump cut in episode 3. Felt very keen, eh? I understood the filmmaking technique. Also seems quite unusual for Doctor Who. Maybe it was a skip in the film or something, but it looked like a jump cut.
I did not notice that, but I'll trust you on it.
Yeah, it was in episode 3 when they're all rescuing Barbara and Susan from the thing, and he's crouching by the wall, and then suddenly it cuts and his cloak is in a different place, and you're like, ooh. But yeah, that's the historical context. I don't know enough about the French Revolution to really go for
I'm afraid.
I've read Les Mis, and that has a big section about the Battle of Waterloo, and a lot of sort of past context about how much everyone fucking hates Napoleon. At one point at the very end of the serial, one of them asks who they think is going to lead France, and Ian says, well, remember the name Napoleon Bonaparte? And the guy just goes, a Corsican! Which is such a weirdly specific piece of, like, French class prejudice to just not like that he's from Corsica. I did do a project on Corsica in Year 8 French, and I found out that there's a regional dialect of Corsican.
Incredibly nerdy.
Very nerdy, yeah. I spent a long time on that. I eventually found an online translator, and then I got an A for it, because of course
I did.
No, we'll all go, except Miss Shaw.
Oh, just a minute, I'm not going to miss all
the... No, Miss Shaw.
Have you never heard of female emancipation?
Liz, this time I think he's right.
Right, where do we start?
Dennis Spooner really said class consciousness, we don't know her. The class stuff in this serial is so whack.
Does not exist.
They're kind of like, oh my god, it's the peasantry. They'll do whatever an aristocrat says, even though there's no more aristocrats. And it's like, guys.
Where is the nuance we love so much?
Episode 5, as it turns out, is where the nuance is hidden.
In that one conversation.
Yeah, it's not great on the class thing. Like, the people with the, like, regional accents are clearly intended to be less intelligent or more easily manipulated. And it's like, come on, guys, come on. Just for once, can we not be classist about regional accents? Please.
I mean, it was the BBC in the 1960s, which was sort of their entire thing. Yeah.
At least we're not watching, like, I don't know, Zed Cars is probably terrible for it.
Have you watched any of that yet?
I've watched some clips.
Have you acquired much of
it? It's actually extremely hard to acquire. I did acquire...
It did sound for a while like you were going down a rabbit hole.
I was going down a rabbit hole of wanting to find out where the fuck all the episodes are. I did acquire a copy of Downtime, the BBV video, so I'm very excited to watch that. Because, you know, it's got the Brig and Victoria and Kate Stewart and I think Sarah Jane is in it.
Nice.
There's a lot going on. I'm excited.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just bad on the class stuff. It's hard to really go into depth because it's just like, yeah, it's just not very good on the class stuff.
And it could have without much difficulty done a little more.
Indeed.
It's not like there wasn't the space for it there. The animation?
Yeah, the animation. We've already mentioned that the editing is extremely strange.
I think
Josh Snares might have done a comparison video where he just talked about why the number of cuts is mental. It was either Josh Snares or Mr. Tardis, friend of the podcast.
We have a lot of friends now.
We do have a lot of friends.
So nice.
We still need to invite him on to an actual episode. I need to figure out how to phrase that. I'm very bad at DMing people.
Do you want me to do it?
I would love you to do it. But so
cool. Just poke me and I'll do it. I'm very bad at
so
remembering
the,
things. But
there's the what is with the 400 cuts a minute, which is just like there's so many cuts and like it's always really close-ups. And I think they're trying to mimic the directorial style, but it doesn't really work because it's too much directing. And the deep fake mouth movements are a little bit disconcerting, although you do get used to it eventually.
I quite liked how much movement there was in their faces compared to the other animation styles.
I think that it's kind of a trade-off where it's more disconcerting, but it does give more expression. So it's kind of...
I appreciate. Yeah. I find that a lot easier to watch.
I think my favourite so far is still the moon base for animation, just because of how fucking good the Cybermen were.
That was a fun one. Yeah. I also liked how they did some fun like camera angles and stuff in some of it, which I don't think would have been there in the original. So I like it when the animations play with the form.
There's a great little feature on the DVD where they have like a 3D tour of all the environments in the animation.
That's cool.
Actually is like a kind of a three-dimensional set in their head, whereas with the newer ones it kind of feels like it's more like a stage play where they're just kind of like, look, we just need to have the characters stand there and talk. We don't have the money for them to interact with
the
space.
We just need to get it done as soon as possible because this is a cursed production.
Yes, we have so little money. But like, I like it. I just think that it could have been done so that it was less hurtful to the eyes whenever they move. There's so much movement of the camera and it's like there's no continuity of motion. Like the fight scene is completely incomprehensible and you'd think that because it's animated they'd be able to make it easier to follow.
They did not. They could have. The choice was probably there for
them. They did not do it. Yeah, so it's definitely kind of a you win some you lose some with the animation. You do have an interesting point here that I'd love to discuss.
Do I? Yes, I do. So David Whittaker had a rule that in historicals, they couldn't alter the past and things would have to turn out the way they actually happened. Could this have limited the amount of pure historicals that were made? And is this too strict a rule for writers to really have fun
I mean, I
with?
Think the argument is that if they change things, it's not a pure historical anymore, I guess is the idea.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, in the new series, they kind of introduced the concept of fixed points in time, right? Where no matter what you do, it will always remain the
same. That will happen somewhere.
Because, like, they kind of get into that in the discussion at the end of the episode when they're like, well, what if we'd written Napoleon a letter telling him what had happened? And Susan just goes, oh, we'd have forgotten it or thought it was crazy. And Barbara goes, I suppose if we'd shot him, the bullet would have missed. like... There's that element of saying that there's no way to change it, not even that there's no point trying to, but just that, like, all the sense that there is no point trying to because it won't work. I think it would be more interesting if they had, like, I think I'm really looking forward to watching the Aztecs because it does go into that concept of changing it and why it won't work.
That'd be really
And then
good.
I'd love if there was one where they accidentally change the past and they come to the future and it's changed, but again, that's not a pure historical.
I also sort of wonder if that because you sort of have to fit into events that already happened. Is it more difficult for writers to come up with intriguing, compelling plots with enough conflict when the
I think it will be better.
Like, you need... It's definitely possible, but it's not something that could be as quick as other scripts.
I think it would be better if they tried smaller stories so that it was possible to feel like that. Like, they do have influence on the narrative in certain ways. Like, they help discover Leon's treachery. And it feels like they're changing very small parts of history. It's almost like they think that the things in the history books are the most important things that happen, which is a very intriguing way of thinking about this.
Never the case. Very rarely the case.
But I...
Especially when you're talking to individual
I think
people.
It makes sense that he had this rule because obviously they're trying to educate the children. I think they could bring back pure historicals now. The issue is that... I think the writers are trying to be... They would end up trying to be too clever with it. It's like, no, I just want to see them participate in this event. Like, the Rosa Parks episode was really interesting because it was almost a pure historical. It was so close to being a pure historical. Same with Demons of the Punjab.
Could you argue that... I mean, with the Rosa Parks one, they... So the thing that's stopping it is the fact that they're the ones who stay on the bus, right?
Yes.
But if that's a fixed point in time, then if they'd got off, and like I know that the Doctor makes a point of being like, no, there'd be enough seats, but surely enough people would get on to make the same outcome happen inevitably.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I guess we'll never know, but
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I like Rosa. I really hate the needle drop at the end, but beyond that, it's a very, very good episode.
Yeah. God, there's a lot of good shit in
Demons of the Punjab is such a good episode, and
I've really liked it. It could have been
a pure historical. Like, it essentially is, except for the presence of other aliens. They could have just had the... I don't know, like, because it's just the observer aliens, right, that show up to be like, we witnessed these parts of these parts of history.
But also, like, were I a companion with the Doctor, I would just want to go back and like see how my ancestors lived.
Yeah,
like I must know.
Yeah,
and just to
I think
be
that
there.
Level of pure historical will be really interesting.
And then you get your conflict coming in from the person relating to themselves and grappling, and it's an internal small story. Mm. But you don't always need grand aliens to tell a grand
Indeed.
Story.
We'd like more historicals, is what we're saying.
Yeah, I think that's where we're at. Us? Wanting more history in our lives?
Who would have guessed?
What? Bucking the trend.
Absolutely insane. Who would have thought? Who would have thought? But yeah, so let us know your thoughts on this. We are just extremely pro-historical. It's possible that someone could give us a good reason why they can't do pure historicals anymore. But,
with no objective, I don't like them.
Indeed. Like, if you don't like them, we don't care. I don't like the Rebus operation. That doesn't stop people from watching it.
I like Mary Tam in the Rebus operation.
Mary Tam is like a universal love. I love her and she is very good. But like the Rebus operation.
No, it's not. Do you know what is good though? The amount of research you've done for the extended universe this week. That frankly intimidates
me. Oh yeah, it's extremely good.
Let me get this straight. A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere in time and space.
Yes.
Quite so.
But that's ridiculous.
So yeah, the Expanded Universe, I read the novelization this time around. It was quite similar to the serial, except that it was slightly gorier, as mentioned. Very sweet. At the beginning, Susan kisses Barbara and Ian, I assume on the cheek, before running out, rather than just hugging them. And I was like, oh, Susan! And also, in
Very
the book,
sweet.
They have to consciously switch between using English and French, which I thought was quite interesting. Like, Ian is not, like, Barbara is better at French than Ian is, and then Susan and the Doctor both speak it, like, perfectly, which is quite interesting. And one of the reasons that Lemaitre is so suspicious of Ian is that he cannot speak French under stress, which is very relatable.
That's really cute.
But yeah, it was very interesting. And then they have Barbara have the realization that it's the French Revolution in the Reign of Terror. Like, she gets all that realization because she's the history teacher. I've screen-capped various instances of Ian being traumatized, just to add to the bank of moments that Ian has been traumatized in Doctor Who.
Yes.
Yeah, so the bit where they reunite is very, very cute. Barbara moved close to the sofa. When she recognized Ian, she almost fainted with astonishment and relief. Ian, you're safe, she cried, kneeling in front of him and taking him tenderly by the shoulders. Jules and Jean exchanged Aww. Puzzled glances as Ian stared at Barbara in confusion and then reacted with a joyful smile. Barbara, he muttered, getting shakily to his feet and raising her up in his arms. Thank God you're all right. And Susan, is she here? And then I've just got a note that just says KISS in all caps, because, like, they need to kiss.
They should.
And then I've just also screen-capped the bit where Ian is extremely stressed out over Barbara and Susan going out on their own to see the physician, and he's just, like, biting his nails, like, oh my god, they're gonna die. Babe. Babe. And then the last bit is where Barbara kisses Ian on the cheek and wishes him good luck and says to take care, and I'm like, oh my god.
Love them. They are married.
They are so in love. I also do have the motivation to write fanfic, like post serial fanfic again, because yes. I did it for Marinus.
Yes,
and I can do it for this.
Yes.
Right, and then I just wanted to mention the presence of France in the expanded universe because I thought it would be funny.
when I saw you write that note on the dock, something inside my brain just snapped, and I stared out the window. No thoughts in my small
extremely
brain.
Extremely big fan of the way that we've mentioned this before on the podcast, that TARDIS Wiki expresses everything as if it has concluded. It is in the past perfect tense. So France was a country in mainland Europe located on Earth. French was a language which originated in this country. Really new information for both of us there.
Oh, beautiful. Love it.
Supposed earthonomics expert Mr. Copper mistakenly referred to the country as Great France of Europe. The 10th Doctor corrected him, clarifying that only Britain was great. Britain's not that great either, Doctor. And that was Voyage of the Damned with Kylie Minogue.
That was a good special. It's a fun one.
The 13th Doctor, Graham O'Brien, Yasmin Khan and Ryan Sinclair visited Gaul in 451 during the wars between the Roman Empire and the invading Huns. Pros: combat magics. I want to read this great one title. Pretty badly. I love anything to do with Gaul. It just makes me think about Asterix. And I love Asterix.
We could, in our ongoing plans for our audio series, set an episode in Gaul.
That would be really...
We could do it. It would fit with the timeline.
That would be really... Philippe Auguste was the king of France who laid the cornerstone for the Louvre in the 12th century, witnessed by one of the first five incarnations of the Doctor, and that's from the audio The Church and the Crown, which is about the 5th Doctor Perry and Eremem visiting France in 1626. And at that time, Georges Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, smuggled an English army into the country to take Paris. Georges Villiers, of course, being James I's boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Bad Gays podcast candidates.
Is that... Very much yes. So.
Then there's an audio called The Iron Maid, where two Zoe and Jamie visited a church in France during the 14th century and found it temporally linked to 1918. Very interested in that.
Oh, that's a
that
cool
is
concept.
In
I
one
like
of the
that.
Second Doctor Adventures box sets, and I need to listen to it. Yes. Of course, there is The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve, which, God, I wish they would discover it because it sounds so interesting. Or animate it. In the 1750s, this is an audio called Death on the Mile, great pun, France fought across Europe against England and Scotland, bound by the Act of Union in the Seven Years' War, which is Sladeen disguised as Sir Edward Scott Cameron would describe as a prequel to World War I, and a glorious affair that spanned continents and consumed countless lives. Fucking Sladeen, man.
They're just everywhere.
It's like, is it a Sladeen or is it a Ratsacoricofallopatorian? We never know.
It's a Ratsacoricofallopatorian because Sladeen is a family name.
I suppose it could have been a member of the Sladeen family. We never know.
Yes, it could have.
The 10th Doctor attempted to take Donna Noble to Blackpool, but they instead arrived in the French Riviera in the 1780s.
We've all been there.
And then there's a novel called The Man in the Velvet Mask, where One and Dodo visit France in an alternate timeline in which Napoleon is the Emperor of France. Obviously, that was what happened in history anyway. They also meet the Marquis de Sade in that book. Novels are wild. It's also the novel which I think established that the Doctor would grow a second heart upon his first regeneration. Obviously, that has now been kind of fucked up by the fact that Ruth is a pre-One Doctor.
Unless One was under the impression that he only had one heart. And
well, Ian's
check,
the one who checks. Ian's
doing.
The one who finds out because it's in Edge of Destruction. It's possible that only one of his hearts was working in the Edge of Destruction and Ian just didn't know. Like, that was why
Did Ian check for two hearts
He heard his heartbeat, and we've established in other serials, like, or other episodes, like, when Martha listens to his heart, she notices that there's two heartbeats.
Martha is a trained medical
professional. I think I would notice if I had two heartbeats, or if someone else had two heartbeats.
Thing is, I don't think
Ian
I would.
Ian was in... he did national service, he's probably done field medicine. He probably can tell when someone's heartbeat is there. In 1879, Rose the Cat piloted the TARDIS to Paris, where she found a mouse.
I love Doctor Who. I just adore this.
And
franchise.
Then there's a little bit about the meddling monk claiming that France would have been better off if Harold Godwinson hadn't died. And it's like, yeah, probably. So that's the history of France in the expanded universe. I'm sure there's other mentions. And obviously in the new series, they go to France in Girl in the Fireplace, which is, you know, inspired by the fact that the Doctor loves the French. The French. Then we have the history of pure historicals, including unproduced stories. So there were 12 pure historical serials produced for Doctor Who, the latest of which was Black Orchid, which is a 5th Doctor, Nyssa Teagan, and Adric story.
Black Orchid is actually perfect.
Yes, excellent to know. So 10 of those stories were the 1st Doctor... Oh no, 10 the 1st Doctor, 1 for 2, and then 1 for 5. So the 1st Doctor had... Let me see if I can list them. It had 10,000 BC, which is the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th episodes of Unearthly Child. Marco Polo, the Aztecs, the Reign of Terror. There are others. The Romans, the Mythmakers.
Massacre?
The Massacre of Simple Thong Muse Eve. That's seven. The Smugglers. Oh,
have you listed Reign of Terror?
I did list Reign of Terror, yeah. I'm trying to get them off the top of my head, off the dome. Smuggler, not the Savages, that's it. Oh, the Crusade, obviously. And then there's one more. I don't remember what it is. If anyone knows, you can write in. And then obviously two had the Highlanders, which was the last one until Black Orc. I love pure historicals. I wish they would come back. It's so weird to me how ubiquitous they are in the first
the Gunfighters?
Huh? The Gunfighters, yes, thank you. So excited for the Gunfighters. I wish they would make a comeback. And it's so weird how ubiquitous they were for one, and then they just phased them out immediately when they got to the second Doctor. I guess because they kind of...
Did they have a different production team as well?
Like, I think they decided that the historicals were less popular, which maybe it was true by that point, but it's still like, you know, stick to your roots. It's fine. I want two to get to dress up in historical costumes.
He would love to do that. We know our little chaotic little man.
So I have a brief history of unproduced pure historicals as well. The first one that is listed on the Wikipedia page is called Britain 408 AD and was going to be written by Malcolm Hulk, communist. We love him. And it was going to be about the departure of the Romans from Britain. And there's lots of clashes against the Celts and the Saxons. Apparently it was going to, quote, culminate with the time travelers fleeing the indigenous savages back to the safety of the TARDIS. And I'm like,
okay, Malcolm. Never love to hear the phrase indigenous savages.
At least they'd be white, I assume. you know, it's just being reductive about the nature of Celtic peoples in the UK.
And what a civilization is made
of. Exactly. So that was first submitted for series one, and then he asked him to resolve it because it was too complicated, or revise it because it was too complicated. And the conclusion was too much like an unearthly child. And they were hoping it would be able to go into the Aztecs and be the slot the Aztecs were in and be directed by Christopher Barry, but they decided not to. And then it was rejected again by Dennis Spooner because he'd already had the Romans in the show.
Can't have them again. Like, England loves the Romans.
Yeah. And then we have, I think we've mentioned this before, Terry Nation's The Red Fort, which was going to be set in the British Raj in India.
Don't know if I would have actually wanted to see this one.
I don't want to have seen this one. I don't think it would turn out great.
I think if we had somebody who was Indian writing it today, we would get a fucking amazing story out of it. I think Terry Nation doing it in the 60s would have got a very racist story
that's
out
why
of it.
I appreciate,
not to brand him as a racist
again,
but...
Demons of the Punjab is great and everyone should just watch that again. And then there was also Farewell Great Macedon, which was going to feature Alexander the Great.
We should get my friend Jim on here, who loves Alexander the Great and is literally doing a PhD in Alexander the Great.
That was going to be written by Morris Fahy, who was a Turkish author apparently. And he actually had a couple of things, of proposals for serials that ended up not getting produced, but you know, he got commissioned to try them out. So this was a 6-part story pitch for season one, and they were going to get framed for murder as part of a conspiracy to kill Alexander the Great. And they had to pass a number of trials to gain the trust of his bodyguard Ptolemy. And the script was published by Nothing at the End of the Lane, which is a Doctor Who restoration magazine, in 2009. And then it was adapted for the Lost Stories range in 2010. I do have the page to buy this bookmarked. One day I will be buying this script. I already have the script for The Masters of Luxor, which is, I thought was a pure historical, but is not. It's about a robot gaining the ability to love or something.
Could we do, like, read-throughs of these scripts?
I would love
fun?
To. I would. Here's a suggestion really I was going to have. Well, we just do The Reign of Terror, but we get someone to translate all of the French characters' lines into French. I was sad it didn't have a French audio track, to be honest, on the DVD. I thought that would be quite fun. And then we've already talked about about the New Armada, and then there was going to be a John Lucarotti story about the Indian Mutiny in 1857. Now, John Lucarotti wrote Marco Polo and was quite well known for being fairly diligent about historical accuracy. Still not sure how that would have turned out. And then...
Could have gone several ways.
Yeah, and then he was also supposed to do one about Leif Erikson, but Donald Tosh, who was the story editor, apparently turned it down because he already had the Vikings in the Time Meddler. And then Lucarotti published it as a short story in Doctor Who magazine in 1992. So, seems interesting.
Called Who Discovered America?
Interesting stuff.
But even then, the Vikings did not discover America. There were already native people living there.
And then we have a story called The Nazis by Brian Hales. And then they abandoned that fairly soon afterwards because they realized that maybe it was a little bit too soon. Just a little bit too soon.
Only 2 decades.
Yeah, and who fucking knows what they were planning to have it be about, but like, yikes. To be fair, Star Trek did then about 2 years later produce a story that could well be called The Nazis.
It was literally they go to a planet and everybody
what's
is a Nazi.
What's that one? It's what's it called?
I don't remember the title. I know I watched it recently.
It's horrendous, like morally and ethically. I do like the bit where they're in prison together, though. That's very homoerotic. There was also going to be one called Bar Kochba. I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm afraid. That was written by Roger Dixon.
Bar Kochba.
And it seems to be what ended up... It seems that it was adapted into The Last Days, the short story that I mentioned, God, probably in the Keys of Marinus episode, about... It is basically about... It was going to be about a Jewish rebel and leading a revolt in 132 AD. And they ended up doing one about... listen to the Keys of Marinus episode. I haven't read the short story since, but it's very good and very sad. And I imagine it has a similar impetus. And then there was no proposed pure historicals until one potentially proposed for season 27 called A School for Glory. Now, I couldn't find any details about this story beyond the fact that it was going to be set during World War One, which obviously I'm intrigued by.
Mm-hmm.
The narrative was planned to alternate between the trenches and a British country house doubling as an army academy. Interesting, because obviously World War One had previously featured in the War Games, although it ended up being a simulation. So I would be interested in it as a pure historical.
And we had some World War Two in season 26.
Yeah, Curse of Fenric. And then in the new series, we had World War One in...
Twice Upon a Time.
I was going to say Family of Blood, actually, but it is in Twice Upon a Time as well, yeah.
Yeah, that too.
And then there was going to be untitled 1920s storyline written by Stephen Fry, but he ended up not being able to write it because he had to rewrite it, and he was like, I don't have time. I don't have time to do this. which is very relatable. And then finally, we have an unsubstantiated rumour that Walt Disney was going to remake the Doctor Who serial Marco Polo as a straight historical adventure film with the element of Doctor and his companions removed.
Oh no! Oh, little mouse,
it's an
do
intriguing
not.
Concept. And they did used to make, like, fairly sumptuous, you know, live-action films, but also, like, what the fuck?
That's a choice.
And then our short trip is just me once again mentioning the insane short story. It's called Mire and Clay, and it's the one where Ian gets captured by Afghan soldiers in 1842 Afghanistan and gets tortured. It is. I don't even know whether the racism in it is malicious or not, but it's extremely present in, like, every other paragraph, and you're like, oh, come on.
You sent me one screenshot, and it was... there.
I just wanted to mention it because it's just another entry in the Ian gets tortured canon, which this serial obviously involves. They make him fight to the death with a guy that he vaguely knows. they mention the TARDIS's translation circuit, which is always useful. The thing is, I can't recommend reading this story, but I also kind of would understand if someone wanted to because it's completely insane.
It sounds... Like a time.
It kind of reminds me of, like, because any mention of the Afghan in kind of a Victorian era, obviously this is earlier, but it reminds me of Sherlock Holmes, because obviously Dr. Watson was involved in the Afghan campaigns in the 1870s and 80s, and it's just, like, very, very odd. And then they make Ian play tug of war over a big pit in the ground that's full of spikes.
Nope. I would like to opt out.
Yeah, lots. I just need to... Oh my god. There's a bit where one of them threatens to cut off someone's dick. I think I've mentioned this before.
We're going to have to put some content warnings in this.
Yeah, it's... I'm just trying to get to the bit where Ian gets rescued, because I remember it being fairly satisfying. It's also, you know, it is vaguely satisfying because in the backstory, Ian and Barbara are pretending to be married. Ah, there we go. The Doctor has appeared. Yeah. Yeah, Barbara kisses him and you're like, yeah, that's satisfying, but also why the fuck did you have the first 15 pages of the story? Why have they published this? Why was this published? Why was this story published?
I mean, you are the one who keeps mentioning it as well. Is this complicity?
I don't know if I can be complicit in the publication of a story that was published in, like, 1998. I was two. I just want people to know how insane this story is. Like, it's... No one's making any money from it anymore. The guy who wrote it has 38 Twitter followers. Like,
That's wild.
It's strange to me. I think it's because it's a logical extrapolation of what the show was doing. And it really reminds you how bizarre it would be if something like this happened on the show now, right? Like, I tweeted about this, but the historicals get so grim. And it's like, it would be if they did like a 4-week serial on CBBC nowadays, where a guy gets strung up and tortured. And everyone was just complaining about the fact that the historical figure who was doing it didn't have a beard. Like...
yeah, you make a lot.
It's a very it's a very strange one, and I don't necessarily think it's bad that they were a little bit grim, because obviously it's portraying a real period in history. But it's just fascinating to think about what is now deemed appropriate for children versus what was deemed appropriate for children in the 1960s.
Yeah, and why that has shifted.
Like, it feels like this scene could have happened in the show, which is bad, and not good.
Yeah,
but you know,
yeah,
it's odd. Obviously not the bit where they threatened to cut someone's dick off. I don't think they would go that far in 1965, but like. It's not a good one. It's not a good one. And that's my expanded universe.
On that note, what a wild little jaunt about the universe you've just taken us on. Shall we go to rankings? My X of the week has got to be like style icon of the week, and it's got to be the Doctor, and it's got to be that hat. I can't be anything else.
Absolutely incredible.
Couldn't
mine possibly. Would be animal of the week, and it's the horse. That horse Ooh. Is just a beautiful horse.
Okay. It's
beautiful
a good horse. We should have more
horses. Apparently, it was very
well
behaved, and it only did one shit on the studio floor.
That's not a bad ratio. That's okay.
I can't be bothered to do a complicated intro for this bit. William Russell, who plays Ian, of course, was in the Blackadder episode The Archbishop as the Duke of Winchester, with Brian Blessed, who played Vargas in the Blake 7 episode Cygnus Alpha. I'm getting really bad at counting these connections. I'm fairly certain this is a connection of two, but it might be three.
Yes.
I'm so bad at counting them. Cygnus Alpha is a good episode. It's the third episode, I think, of the show, and it's about a cult. And Brian Blessed is, of course, the
I
cult
like
leader.
Cults.
You like cults? Cancels.
Of course,
yes. But yeah, this was, I was panicking because I, it was about 20 minutes before recording was going to start, and I realised I hadn't
exactly
done it
20 minutes.
Because I was on a Skype call with my family, and I went, oh no! So while I was on a Skype call with my family, I had to simultaneously research Six Degrees of Blake 7. So this one was pleasantly easy. And also I need to rewatch this episode of Blackadder, because I've probably seen it like once.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. I think it's all on BritBox. We really ought
I
to
own
be
it on DVD.
Like sponsored
I own
by
it
Brit
on DVD,
Box
but I would
stage.
Probably watch it on BritBox. We really should. We just mention it all the time because it's great. It's fucking great. What have they added to BritBox this week? Let's have a look.
We can't.
They added
Goth Marenghi.
They added Goth Marenghi.
Okay.
Oh, Withnail and I. I've been wanting to watch that.
Oh my god. Have
no,
you seen it
I need to.
Oh, it's a tie. I highly
Two
recommend
doctors.
It.
The Imitation Game, which I'm not interested in. Death on the Nile.
No.
Pink Taylor Soldier Spy. Dead Man's Shoes. Murder on the Orient Express. The Third Man. The Elephant Man. Celebrity X on the Beach.
Lots of man.
Brighton Rock. That's got William Hartnell in it.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's like a gangster in it, which is extremely amusing to me, conceptually.
I think he would be interesting
in
that role.
I mean, I haven't really seen him in any other roles besides The Doctor, so I'd love to find out more. What's next on our list of things we have to do? out of five.
Out of five. I'd probably give it a solid 3 head traumas out of five.
I would give it...
I imagine you're going to rank it
significantly higher. Not significantly higher. I would give it 3.5 relieved reunion hugs out of five.
Aww.
Like, it is... I acknowledge that my love of it is disproportionate to the quality of the serial, but I do think it's pretty good. And I think the fucking DVD, which I don't have next to me, has like, on the inside cover, it has the leaflet, and it basically says this is an underrated historical. And I do think it's underrated for the First Doctor era, because I think it's really good. And it certainly drags less than some of the other ones.
Yeah. Where do we want to put it on our big chunky ranking?
Let me have a look. I have, I don't have that spreadsheet open. I have the other spreadsheet I created open. Which is tracking our completion rate of different doctors.
I would probably put this somewhere around the Rescue the Two Doctors.
Mm. It's quite difficult. This is kind of the area where there's a lot that we really liked, isn't it? I would put it, I think...
This is only going to get harder.
Would I put it above or below Marinus? That's a real question.
I've put it below Marinus because I enjoy Marinus more. But again, that's subjective
In
enjoyment.
In that case, I would go above Two Doctors and below Rescue...
Happy Hell with yeah. that?
Because obviously The Rescue has our perfect little girl, Vicky, in it, and we love her very much.
We love her.
And again, it
so
has an
much.
Interesting exploration of trauma in it. It's almost like the first Doctor era is actually quite psychologically complex.
And how do you rate the novelization?
I thought it was actually really good. It was better than The Rescue, because The Rescue had the ending tacked on by apparently a different writer. The ending really annoyed me.
That's
the novelization.
That's wild.
Because, you know. But the Reign of Terror one was pretty good.
And what about the Doctor Who magazine?
Where do we think
rankings?
It's
going to
be?
I'm going to say somewhere in, like, the 180s.
I'm going to say 90, just to be optimistic. It's 144. Quite low, but, you know, sort of bang in the middle of what we said. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, indeed. Good on us for...
Once again.
balancing
once again,
out.
We are extremely out of whack with the Gallifrey Matrix DWM Mighty 200 rankings, because we have superior and impeccable taste, of course.
Which is why we are creating this this podcast, to document it for the
yes,
rest
absolutely.
Of time.
Thank you very much to everyone for listening to our extremely good podcast. What was it? Polarity, l'inversion.
L'inversion de polarity.
L'inversion de polarity. What would it be? Merci d'écouter à votre podcast. j'espère que vous... vous serez...
Do you want to do it in English?
I'm trying to think what it would be in French. J'espère que vous nous aimez, etc. But yeah, thank you very much for listening to our podcast, Reversing Polarity. Feel free to rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe to us on whatever podcatcher of you desire. If you would like to follow us on other social media, our podcast Twitter is at Polarity Pod, and my Twitter is at .sayers. Ames is at Aim Tell Stories. That's AYM Tell Stories. We are also on Tumblr at polaritypod.tumblr.com, where we used to post, like, you know, useful stuff, and now it's mostly me screaming in tags about how much I love all the companions.
Also valid.
Feel free to join us next time. We will be watching The Stones of Blood. How does it feel?